Welcome to the Exotic Pet Collective. My name is Richard, and today we're starting a new series on the podcast. It's Tarantula Keepers Around the World, or I guess I should say Exotic Keepers Around the World. We're going to be talking to different keepers of snakes, scorpions, tarantulas, stuff like that in different countries and kind of comparing and contrasting the differences in the hobby based on, you know, which country that you're in. But first, I do need to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's podcast, and that is TarantulaCribs.com. If you're looking for high-end, very clear, strong, secure enclosures for your tarantulas, scorpions, or pretty much any invert or reptile, as long as it's like a small reptile, you should definitely check out TarantulaCribs.com. I actually just moved my Arizona desert centipede into one of their enclosures. They sent me one of the largest enclosures. I was going to put a T. blondie in there, but I got to wait a little bit for that substrate to come in, so I figured My centipede needs a new enclosure. Let's try it out. And it's been a few days, and it has not been able to escape. It's really seemed to settle in, so I can vouch for them working for some species of centipedes. So if you want to get yourself some really cool enclosures, go check out their website, tarantulacribs.com, and use the promo code TCollective10 at checkout to receive 10% off your entire order. Now, on today's podcast, we have a special guest. He is from South Africa and reached out to me. I think it was on Instagram possibly, or I don't even remember how he reached out to me. We started talking, and I've been fascinated about the exotic pet hobby in South Africa. I've had multiple people leave comments on YouTube videos and Instagram posts, kind of just telling me about some species that they're not able to keep in South Africa and some other differences. So I thought it'd be really cool to get somebody on the podcast from that country to talk about all the differences. So I want to welcome to the podcast for the first time a special guest. This is Mike from Mike's Exotics. Whoops, I hit the wrong one. Welcome, Mike. Hey, sorry, man, for the rim shot. It's awesome to have you, man. How are things going in South Africa?
It's pretty hot at the moment. I mean, it's, what's the time now? 7:20 in the evening, and it's baking. It's roasting at the moment. So I've got the AC on. I actually got a new AC installed upstairs, really just for the tarantulas, because it's too hot for them. So
oh wow,
trying to just keep things a little bit cooler.
So you're in the middle of summer right now. Is that correct? Or like towards the end of summer?
Yeah.
How is that season?
It's sort of approaching the end of summer. So we've got the last major thunderstorms and heat spells kind of coming now.
Yeah.
Things should start cooling off within the next month or so. Things should slowly start getting a bit cooler.
Yeah. That's something interesting that's kind of happened, at least in my own mind, over the past year or so. Like as the YouTube channel's grown and I've started talking to people in other countries and other places around the world, It's like I always knew that the seasons were different, you know, whether you're in the northern or southern hemisphere. But for whatever reason, sometimes in my brain, you know, you get that like syllabistic kind of like mindset that, you know, how I experience reality is how everybody else experiences reality. So it's like, yeah, it's winter and cold here, so it's winter and cold everywhere in the world.
Look, man, I mean, I lived in Iowa for like 2 years, and it was, I mean, when I would be in Iowa, sometimes I'm not so good with Fahrenheit, so I'll just say it wasn't centigrade, but it was like minus 30 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
And my friends back home were at the lake sort of swimming and boating, and I'm standing outside doing little, just to see how cold it is, throwing hot air into the water, and it all of a sudden turns to like this snowy mush. So, and also coming from South Africa to that sort of temperature, it'll mess with you. It'll mess you big time.
So were you born and raised in South Africa?
That's correct. I was born and raised in South Africa. And then when I was about 17, I went to Israel for a bit. And then after Israel, I went to the UK for 8 years, and then the US for 2 years. And then now, for now, I'm back in SA for the foreseeable future.
Oh, wow. So you've been pretty much a little bit everywhere. I have to ask, though, of all of the places in the U.S. you could go to, how did you end up in Iowa?
So it was actually because of a girl I'd met in the U.K. She lived in Iowa, and I went there. I wasn't expecting much, but
yeah,
dude, the Midwest and the South is just – it is home for me. It's where I want to get back to. It's where I want to spend the rest of my days. I loved every second of it. It was just the people I met. So it was just – and oh man, and the people are just so down to earth. Like what you see is what you get, just salt of the earth people. If I'd never see Los Angeles again or New York again, That's fine. Midwest and the South is where it's at in my book.
Nice. Yeah, I actually went to college in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is like right next door to Iowa. And my roommate was from Iowa, and we would go there a lot, especially on the weekends. And I mean, there's not a lot there, but cornfields. We're like driving for hours. Look, I'm like, is there any towns or anything?
We lived in a small town. And I mean, yeah, it's like kind of like, I mean, what? Guns and Bush Light is kind of like the main thing. And Casey's Pizza. Cannot forget Casey's Pizza. That's where it's at.
Right? What town were you in, if you don't mind
me asking? It was called Clarinda, Iowa. Mm. It was about an hour and a half outside of Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, Omaha was sort of the closest major city, I would say, and then beyond that, you could go into Missouri and go to Kansas City. So
yeah, it was. I worked at a used record shop, so I mean, that tells you how long ago this was. A used CD shop, and my manager was from Omaha. We ended up being roommates, like moved into his house for a while, and we go down to Omaha sometimes to see his friends and family, and yeah.
I mean, Omaha is a good time, but I mean. Yeah, I mean, as I say, the people that I met and the people that I socialized with were just, I cannot speak highly enough of them. But some of the questions I got asked when I told them, hey, I'm from South Africa, that was a bit awkward trying to deal with that. I mean, a lot of people thought I was just like, you're lying, you're from Australia or New Zealand.
Like,
just don't insult me, I'm not from Australia. You can say I'm from New Zealand, that's fine. But this is where the whole rugby thing comes in.
Okay.
Rugby is very competitive with South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. So.
See, I did not know that. My sister played rugby in college.
Oh, shit. Awesome. Okay. Yeah. Awesome, man.
I think she just liked to really hurt other women. That was, I don't know how good she was, but man, she was brutal.
Yeah. I mean, I started playing rugby in a town called Maryville in Missouri. Again, kind of, it was a college town. And that was a lot of fun, playing rugby there. And it seems to be picking up in the States, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, you guys are good at most things. Why it's not rugby, I don't understand. Compared that weird game called football, we have to wear all that padding and that's not where it's at.
It was fun. Actually, I went to visit her in college. I guess it was her freshman year or maybe it was her sophomore year. I don't even remember, but, she was staying at it was like a sorority house, but I don't think it was a sorority. Okay. It was just like where all of the girl rugby players, went, and she invited me to the party, and I showed up, and we were there I was probably there for an hour, kind of drinking and hanging out, and realized that they were pretty much like, you're not welcome here, buddy. Like, you need to get out of here. It's like, okay, I'm sorry. I'll leave. Yeah, I did not quite fit in with that crowd. But, I mean, that was 20 years ago or probably more than that. I was in like a serious kind of punk rock phase at the time. And yeah, I just wasn't really getting along with the rugby ladies. But
fair enough.
So where can you give us a little bit of background about, you know, how you got into exotic pets and what kind of pets you keep and stuff like that?
Basically what I first started keeping was, when I was younger, I used to work at a reptile exotic store here in SA, actually in Johannesburg. And I used to keep just various snakes, corn snakes to Burmese pythons, to bearded dragons and all of that. It's sort of then escalated from there. When I immigrated over to the United Kingdom, I had to sell all my snakes and all that, obviously, before I went over. And when I was in the UK, I got back into keeping snakes and various lizards and things like that. And then once I got to the US, the sort of attraction of tarantulas got to me. Up until that point, I'd been petrified of any form of spider. Reptiles I can handle, no problem. Spiders, tarantulas, I was deathly scared of. And I was watching a show, I think it was Dark Den who I was watching while I was in the States. And I was just like, this is amazing. Like, I want to learn more about these creatures and they seem fascinating. And I then went to a site there, I believe it was called Jenny's Tarantulas, I think. And I bought from her and I got myself, it was a curly hair and a Viculera, I think it was. And I fell in love with them. I didn't keep anything more really than that. It was maybe two other tarantulas. I kept snakes as well. And then on coming back to SA, I wanted to continue the hobby and passion, mm-hmm. But I didn't have the time. And now I'm sort of doing my own thing job-wise. It's I'm lucky enough to be able to do that. And I kind of had that urge again and I got back into it. And now, I mean, I'm sitting with probably over 40 tarantulas. So wow. going very, very quickly. I just actually had a rack system installed today, one of three rack systems. It's got digital thermostats and lighting and all of that. Unfortunately, I couldn't set my camera up to show it to you, but it's next minute. I'm into it now pretty heavily.
So yeah.
It doesn't help that the store that I get my stuff from, I'm not joking, is a minute drive from me. So.
Oh, wow. that's pretty handy.
Yeah. It's not good in the pocket. Let me put it that way.
So I'm curious, like when you're going from the UK to the US and then the US back to South Africa, do you pretty much just have to like sell your entire collection before you move, or are you able to import them into the country you're moving into?
You could do the whole case of importing, but the fees that you'll pay to get the permits and whatever to bring them over, it's just not worth it. You can sell to another collector, make your money back in some instances, depending on what you have. And then just sort of rebuy in that country. You know, that's what I had to do coming from the US back to SA. And that's what I've done. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. I've always kind of wondered about that. Like if I were to ever leave the country, you know, like move somewhere else, if I would have to, that's probably what's going to keep me where I am right now, because I don't think I could sell them. And I don't think I would want to unless somebody came in and bought them all at once or something like that.
No, I completely get where you're coming from. I mean, I've got some now pretty rare stuff. You know, what perhaps it's rare in South Africa isn't rare in the US, but by South African standards, some of it's pretty rare. I wouldn't want to get rid of it, but you know, my hopes are to go and live in Austin, Texas. And of course I've got to sell everything. I cannot go through the process of trying to get the permits and whatever and go through that system to try and bring it all over. It's just not worth it. And I have a feeling some of it would die on the aircraft anyway. So yeah. I don't want to go through that.
That would be a tough trip for a tarantula to make.
Yeah.
Austin, Texas. It would be. That's interesting. Yeah. A lot of people are moving to Austin right now, especially from like California. A lot of people from LA are moving out that way. Yeah. My wife loves that. Like she has, through her job, she does a lot of like conferences and stuff like that. It seems like once a year, every other year, they end up having it in Austin. And she's always like, "You got to come with me. You got to come with me." This town is amazing.
If you've never been to Austin, go for it. Seriously, just go for it. It is fantastic. It's an amazing time. You've got sort of this brilliant, brilliant vibe in Austin, Austin City. And then if you want the sort of outdoorsy bit of stuff, it's 20, 30 minutes outside of Austin. You're back to cattle ranches and all of that. I mean, it's the perfect lifestyle, but the best of both worlds.
Very cool. Yeah, I really wanted to go at least check out Austin. I mean, back in my younger days, I used to drive all over the country just kind of, being a transient hippie guy, just driving around, visiting other places. I mean, I've lived from everywhere from Alaska to Florida.
Alaska, that's beautiful, man.
Went to Maine for a while. But the Southwest is not an area that I really went too often. I mean, I went to... Sedona, Arizona, for our honeymoon when we got married.
Okay.
And I loved it. Like, but before then, I never went to the Southwest because it was, well, one, I, before I really got into tarantulas, I was just kind of scared to death of spiders and snakes and stuff like that. So I'm not going to intentionally go somewhere where they're very abundant, but I'm also a redheaded guy. So like, if it's really sunny and hot, then I also stay away from there because I don't like sunburns.
I'm very fair skinned. I mean, I get this British sort of lobster look once I'm exposed to the sun for too long. And the rest of my family tans and they look like they're like Greek gods and goddesses.
Yeah.
I'm just like this red lobster that comes. It's horrible, man. I remember at one point I did a trip sort of through the South and then going into Louisiana and then from Louisiana into Texas. And that's sort of how we ended up in Austin.
Yeah.
Man, Florida is a crazy place.
Yes, it
Florida is. Florida is a crazy place.
And I spent probably too much time there. I was there for about 8 years. It was kind of, it was a similar situation to what you were describing. Like I had met a girl and we had started dating for a while and her dad and stepmom lived in Daytona Beach. And we're like, we need to change the scenery. We went down there and visited in February, and it was amazing. You know, it was like 70 degrees every day and on the beach. I was like, this is perfect. This is my type of place. And then we moved back down. And so that was February, March. It was probably April. It was right at the beginning of hurricane season. We decided we're going to move down there, packed everything up, found an apartment. And actually, no, we stayed with her family for like a month before we got our apartment.
Right, okay.
Just so we could kind of get settled in, get a job, find a nice place. And when we moved, one of my main concerns was hurricanes. And her dad was like, there hasn't been a hurricane hit Daytona Beach of any significance in 40 years. And I was like, oh, okay, so we'll be safe. 2 weeks after we moved in, I don't remember which one. I think it was Hurricane Charlie or something like that came through, knocked out power for 2 weeks, destroyed. It was a mess. I was like, why did I do this?
Look, I didn't experience hurricanes, but I remember in Iowa, it's like sort of that tornado kind of belt. And I never understood what the sirens were going off in town until the girl I was dating at the time. She's like, yeah, that means we kind of got to get into the basement. I'm like, we got to get to the basement. Like, how close is this thing?
Yeah.
I mean, and a tornado, I you could see one was sort of on the outskirts of town. I never reached it.
Yeah.
But man, those things are scary up front. Like, I don't think anybody understands, like, just how powerful a full blown tornado is. It's scary stuff.
Yeah. It was my freshman year of college. I was staying in the dorms. Like, the freshman dorms were only three stories tall, but I was kind of seeing this girl. I was in the upperclassmen dorms, which were like maybe, I don't know, 10 stories, 12 stories tall. And so we were up at the top and the alarms went off. And I'm like, I thought it was, you know, I don't know what I thought it was. And she's like, we need to go down to the basement. And I'm like, what are you talking about? But from her room, we could look out and see the tornado a few miles away. Yeah. I was like, okay, yeah, we'll go to the basement.
we're going to go now. And another interesting point, by the way, in Austin, Texas, is Elon Musk's moved his whole plant there from California. And I mean, I'm a South African. I kind of have a love towards Elon. I love what he stands for. So it's like, you know, it's a no-brainer. Elon's swearing by Texas, and Joe Rogan's now, you know, Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Kind of got to go, man. I got to go.
Yeah. It seems like all of comedy and tech is moving out there right now.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
It's on a complete boom, and it seems like they're offering a lot of tax incentives and things like that. So they want people to move there. It's fantastic. It's great to see.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to go check it out sometime. I think part of it was, I mean, one, it's kind of like that desert area that I tried to avoid for many years. But also, I don't know, I don't want to offend anybody from Texas, but I was afraid to go to Texas. I'd heard so many horror stories of the police pulling you over and robbing you and stuff. I was like, yeah, we'll just drive around Texas. We'll go up through Oklahoma and go back down.
Look, I mean, I think I got pulled over in Iowa quite a couple of times. And they would often say, like, where are you from? And I'm like, South Africa. And they're like, Africa? That's – what are you doing in Iowa, boy? I can totally see that.
I'm
seeing my girlfriend. It's like, you know, it's part of a – it's very, like, almost cinematic the way these sort of things play out. But, I mean, as I say, I love it. And it's a brilliant – you live in a brilliant country, man. It's awesome.
It's amazing. So what kind of – you said you have that exotic pet store kind of right down the road from you. What are like the popular exotic pets in South Africa for people to keep?
So more popular would definitely be reptiles, snakes, lizards of various kinds, obviously the usual bearded dragons and all of that. But a lot of people are now keeping ball pythons and getting into breeding of specific kinds of that. That's becoming very, very popular at the moment. I mean, the guy dropped off my tarantula rack today, not rack, shelving system is called that. He had in the back of his truck another system, which was literally for, I believe it was 50 or 60 ball pythons. You know, so that's immediately going to somebody. And ball pythons is the main thing. We used to be able to keep Burmese pythons, no longer allowed to keep Burmese pythons, unfortunately. So that was quite popular at one stage. I mean, I had an albino Burmese python that I loved, and I wouldn't be able to keep that nowadays. So
So is the tarantula hobby growing in South Africa, or is it?
It's
still pretty small. So
I would say at the moment we have about between 2,000 and 5,000 active keepers of that. Maybe I'm hitting those limits a bit high, but there are a lot of people keeping it, and it's definitely becoming more popular. You know, for instance, what a lot of people I believe are now finding is if you travel a lot to go away a lot, a tarantula is a lot easier to leave to care for itself than leaving something like a snake or a lizard that needs constant monitoring and attention. And that's making it very attractive to people to want to keep. It's definitely on the rise and more people are finding out about it. And I think that's kind of what spurred me on as well to sort of start this YouTube channel, is to show people, you know, how to look after these creatures and what's going on in the scene, and to show that it's not anywhere near, I suppose different breeds are obviously different, but your average tarantula, like a curly or something, it's not that complex to look after.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're going to have to forgive a lot of my ignorance. When it comes to, especially other countries, my exposure and understanding is usually fairly limited. And I don't mean this to sound disrespectful at all. I hope it doesn't. But you know, I almost embarrassed to say this. I'll be honest with you.
No, say it, go for it, dude.
You don't even know what I'm going to say.
No, it's not going to be that embarrassing, dude. I'm living in Iowa. I got asked, do I ride lions to school and all of this kind of stuff. So trust me, it's what you say. It's fine.
Well, my exposure, my understanding of South Africa is predominantly that information comes from De Antwoord and their music videos.
Okay. So, yeah, De Antwoord.
So the only reason I bring that up is I don't remember if it was in a song or one of their videos or something like that, but they were talking about there was like a bunch of different languages that are spoken in South Africa.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, when you make YouTube videos, like, is there a language barrier? Like how are you able to reach a wide demographic of people in South Africa?
So first of all, South Africa recognizes 11 official languages. It's a lot.
Oh, wow.
I wouldn't be surprised if we're one of the only countries maybe who recognizes that many languages. We have a lot of different people that live here. I mean, South Africa it's referred to as a rainbow nation. There's a lot of different people and followings that live here.
Yeah.
The main, I'd say that everybody can speak English. So, you know, you're taught English as a first language at school. So it's not really a problem to sort of get by and talk English.
Yeah.
The second language would probably be something like Afrikaans, which is, it was from the old Dutch settlers who were here. And Afrikaans almost sounds, if you ever had to search Flemish, which is spoken in Belgium, it's very similar to that. Speaking English, most people can understand it. Most people can definitely get by with it. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I can't believe I just admitted to thousands of people that I listen to De Antwoord, but it made me very curious.
No, look, I mean, so De Antwoord, they would speak Afrikaans. Like that's, you can tell listening to the accent that's their first language. English would obviously be second. Mine is, I speak, I think, only English, a tiny smidge of Afrikaans, but I wasn't the best at school, so yeah. I didn't really learn it. So.
Now, I've gotten multiple comments from people from South Africa, or maybe it's just the same person commenting a lot. I don't really know, but
okay. It
seems anytime I do a video on, especially if it's like an African baboon species, one of their comments is, you know, I love this tarantula. I wish I could have it, but we're not allowed to keep him in South Africa. Like, what exactly are the rules or laws regarding, you know, keeping different species in Africa?
So how it works with tarantulas, and I stand to be corrected on this, but my understanding is that any tarantulas that are indigenous to our country, you may not keep. So such as an OBT or something like that, because it lives here and it exists here, yeah. You are not allowed to, that's literally what it is. You're not allowed to keep it. So we can keep stuff from Malaysia and India and Brazil and all of that. But as soon as it comes to keeping a baboon species from here, it's a no-go. It's an absolute no-go. I mean, I was on a safari trip December, and we came – I can't remember what species it was, but it was a baboon tarantula that was, you know, really, really big. And I was like, man, I wish I could keep this thing. And it's not allowed. So you can see them roaming around, and sometimes they'll come into your house depending on where you live.
Oh, wow. But
get caught with it. And there are people that do sometimes risk keeping such a thing.
Yeah.
If the local authorities find out that you are keeping it, not only does that get removed, but your entire collection gets removed. So it's just not worth the risk. It's not worth doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's usually the videos that I have, like a orange baboon tarantula or the Harpictera polkerpiece. I always want to say polkerpes, but I've been corrected recently. It's polkerpies, I believe.
Don't worry. I'm still learning the Latin names for things. So unfortunately, you will hear that I use the sort of the normal names. I'm sorry about that. I do apologize in advance.
That's all right. No worries. No judgment. So the... is the baboon like Africa? Is it restricted to the south, like species that are endemic to South Africa, or is it like a continental thing? Like you can't keep any tarantulas that are in Africa.
Again, I stand to be corrected, but it's as far as I'm aware, it is only those that are in South Africa which are not allowed to be kept. If something comes in from Kenya, that's allowed to be kept. I believe the feather-legged baboon, I believe, is sort of more northern Africa. I believe that's, that we're allowed to keep. It's just stuff that is surviving and living here and has made its home here. Mm-hmm. It's a no-go. You can't keep it. And unfortunately, that is where we get affected, with things like the OBT and stuff like that. It's a pity, but we're just not allowed to keep it.
Yeah.
And you can apply for permits to keep it, but your chances of being granted a permit are near zero unless you have a really, really good reason as to why you need to, want to keep it.
Right. And I'm sure that's so... to kind of restrict people from going out in the wild and just constantly collecting them and demolishing their, their population out there.
I would say, our conservation in South Africa is very, very good. And they do try their best to, what's the word I'm looking for here? To look after our local wildlife as much as possible. Australia is also very restrictive on that kind of stuff. We're quite similar to Australia in that way.
Yeah.
Even some, a bit of New Zealand, but
That's very good though. I mean, I'm sure as a keeper of exotic pets, it can be frustrating because like the OBT is probably one of the most common tarantulas in the hobby, at least here in the US, just because they're so easy to breed and so beautiful. It seems like a lot of places will just give you, if you place an order for tarantulas, you spend over $100, they'll just throw in an OBT. So it's
you could have one literally stroll into your house, but you can't keep it. So we're lucky in that regard. I mean, you sort of go outside and you're looking in your garden, it's like, that's an OBT. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Then there's even sections of one section of SA. So the best way I can refer to it is call it states, if you will. So I live in Gauteng state. Then there's the Northwest state, which is the main city there is Cape Town. I don't know if you've heard of Cape Town, but it's basically in that area, you are not allowed to keep tarantulas at all. So no tarantulas may be kept.
Oh, wow.
Because they are run by a different government and they sort of monitor things a little bit more stricter. So they don't want something getting out and affecting that local, the local species there, and causing drama that side. So if you live, sort of in the Cape, I said Northern Cape earlier, it's Western Cape. If you live in the Western Cape, you can't do it. I mean, if you order online, I mean, we do have websites where obviously, people online, nothing can be taken into the Western Cape. It'll stay specifically. It's not allowed there.
Gotcha. Yeah, I follow, I think his name's Dan Mace on YouTube, and he's Cape Town, he's a South African YouTuber. Have you ever watched his stuff?
I haven't. No, he's a vlogger of some kind, I imagine.
Yeah, he was friends with Casey Neistat, who's a big vlogger.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, he put out some interesting videos.
Married to, yeah, I think Casey Neistat's married to a South African girl, I think.
That is correct, yeah. And he's like a film, Dan is like he makes just different films, indie films, commercials, stuff like that. And he just pretty much is vlogging, I think, his life in South Africa right now. But I mean, he kind of travels all over the place, but it's good stuff, especially if you're making YouTube videos, to watch his channel, because he talks a lot about different ways to kind of create content on YouTube. It's very interesting.
I'm going to give it a watch.
I enjoy it. It's awesome. Always kind of fascinated me because I live in West Virginia, which, is like, it's kind of, and in like the northern part of West Virginia, I'm like between Ohio and Pennsylvania, like four hours maybe from the Canadian border. So, I mean, it gets really cold here.
Yeah.
essentially the environment here is not sustainable for pretty much any tarantula really to live. I mean, I'm sure there are a few species, but so I never really have that worry or concern that if something were to escape, it'd be able to survive in the wild, because essentially the first winter would come through and probably kill anything that got away. But like when you're living in the Southwest and places like that, you know, it could be very viable, or especially like Florida and you know, the Southeast, you know, where it's a lot more humid. Asian fossorials and arboreals, you know, tarantulas from other places of the world would more than likely be able to have plenty of prey and the right environmental conditions to live in the wild.
One only has to look at Florida's, you know, problem with things like iguanas and Burmese pythons and stuff like that have just been released into the Everglades, and that stuff thrives there. I mean, it's like a perfect breeding ground for it, perfect climate, perfect everything.
Yeah, they even have a colony of the Chilicato vagans, the Mexican red rump tarantulas, that had some, I guess, from what I remember reading, it was sometime in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, some had been released in an orange grove. And now there's like an established community, you know, of Mexican red rump tarantulas in like outside Tampa. Just because like the conditions are perfect, there's plenty of prey for them. And it's very similar to the Yucatan Peninsula as far as like an environment. Where they're native, so yeah, they're thriving out there, which is kind of wild. So you know, if you're living in somewhere like South Africa, I could imagine it would be
it would be a problem if things started getting out. I could see it definitely being a problem. You know, we don't have extreme cold temperatures. You know, it doesn't happen. I mean, our winters are not that severe. It's, you know, for these creatures, I think some creatures would die off. Maybe it would get a little bit chilly depending on where they got released. But specifically where I live, which is sort of near Johannesburg in the Gauteng state, if you want to call it, things would stand a pretty good chance of survival. It's good climate, good weather, an abundance of food. So it's the last thing you want happening is that sort of stuff happening. But, you know, I think most keepers here in SA who are in the hobby want to learn, want to conserve, want to look after these creatures. And they're proud to be a part of the hobby. You know, it's kind of like a niche market here, and that makes it very, very special in its own way. And the people involved are very special themselves. You know, they sort of seen this as a new and exciting thing, and they want to help preserve it and look after it. That's it.
Yeah, that's actually something we talked about a lot on the podcast, it seems. No matter who I'm talking to or what, you know, kind of exotic pet we're talking about, it always at some point touches on this topic that you just brought up about like just how the pet trade or, you know, keeping exotic pets and conservation kind of go hand in hand. It feels like a lot of people, like myself included, probably don't even never really cared about tarantulas or scorpions or, you know, even conservation of a lot of different reptile species until I really got into the hobby. And by keeping them and learning a lot about them and where they're from and a lot of times how endangered or threatened they are in the wild, you really kind of develop this appreciation for them. And that leads to having a desire to, you know, be involved in conservation of that species in the wild and
definitely,
you know, not wanting to get involved with, you know, brown boxing or smuggling tarantulas illegally out of countries. And
100%.
And it seems like there's this, this perception from people outside of the exotic pet hobby that people like us don't care about that kind of thing. Like all we care about is getting those species and keeping them in our house and breaking laws and doing whatever we can to smuggle these species out and keep them illegally or shade, you know, just shady and stuff like that, when it's really the opposite is true. And part of like why I'm doing this podcast and you know, just all the different social media accounts is one of the reasons is to kind of raise awareness that pet keepers are as big into conservation as conservationists in some areas, in some ways, if that makes sense.
Look, I mean, I think a lot of people also view it as a bit like, you know, they see it, their exposure to it has been, I don't remember that Netflix special, The Tiger King. You know, that what is his name? Joe Exotics, I think.
That's it, Joe Exotic, yep.
Joe Exotic, and they see that and then they're like, oh, then everybody's like that. And, you know, it's not at all. It's, you know, sure, you get your bad apple out of the bunch. Of course that's going to happen. But I think the majority of us want to just look after these creatures. And, you know, I'll be first to admit, I was terrible with spiders. I was terrible with any form of tarantula. I remember as a little kid, we'd get them in my parents' home. And my first instinct was, I just want to kill this thing. I want to be done with it. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of, as I say, I got to the US and that sort of changed me. I was watching Dark Den and I was like, this is amazing. I mean, this creature is really something special. There's something to learn here. And I got my curly hair and it was on my hand or whatever. And I was mesmerized by this thing. I was like, this is something along, I guess reptiles can almost be classed in the same respect where they haven't changed much from the time of dinosaur era sort of stuff. This thing is built to perfection and it's something that should be studied and admired and yes, sense of caution, but with that caution should come respect for this animal. And I think if you've put those two together, you've got a wonderful thing going.
That's one of the aspects of tarantulas and scorpions and stuff that, I really get enthralled by is millions of years of evolution that's honed these things into these amazing, hunting machines and just alien looking creatures. Like a lot of the arachnids out there don't look like anything else on our planet, and not just tarantulas and scorpions, but even like isopods and stick insects and, pretty much any invert, it's like a whole different evolutionary kind of arm that's shot out that I find. And the more you learn about them, the more fascinating they become. I mean, it's not just they look cool, but just their entire lifestyle and the way that they just the biology of them is really fascinating as well.
Look, I mean, that's why on my channel, I sort of like to incorporate a lot of that. I think, sometimes it might feel that, I guess to myself, I feel that I talk a bit too much about it, but I like to incorporate the isopods. Like I've now recently started putting isopods and springtails within my enclosures, finding the perfect balance, obviously with the more humid species. And it's just how it all works together. How it's, it's fascinating, man. It's like, I don't know, it's like you get excited dealing in this. You get excited being a part of this. And I think some people at first might be grossed out or whatever. And it's just, I like to try and think that, myself, you, we can make people appreciate this and see what it is. Even if you might say, I'm never going to keep something like this.
Yeah.
I can still appreciate it for what it is. I may, and now instead of where if it came into my house, I want to kill it or something, I'd now rather cup it, put it outside. There's no need to kill this creature. It's not out there to get me. In fact, all it wants to do is get away from me as quickly as possible.
Yeah. I actually was responding to some comments today on YouTube about people that had I posted a question that was like, how did you even come across my channel? Did YouTube recommend it or did you see the Facebook, and people have been leaving comments kind of just telling me a little bit about how they stumbled across my content. And there is more than a few people who are like, I don't keep tarantulas. I don't even really like tarantulas, but YouTube recommended a video. I watched it and just kind of became fascinated by it. They were like, you were really excited about it and kind of got enthralled. And even though I don't keep them, I really appreciate them now and I'm enjoying the content. And to me, that's fascinating. People that don't like tarantulas or keep tarantulas are watching, videos about tarantulas on YouTube.
And it's easy for somebody to, watch us on YouTube because before it was sort of like this thing where you'd have to go on Discovery Channel or Nat Geo or something like that.
Yeah.
Now they can just search it on YouTube and you've got something far more personalized. Like we're basically talking to the audience and guiding them through this process of keeping these incredible creatures. And, I just want to keep doing it for as long as possible, really. And it's just, I think a lot of times people have a sort of perception of specifically Africa in general, that we don't really do this kind of stuff. Yeah. And it's nice to get out there and be like, hey, we're up there with you guys. We've doing it all, man. Yeah, sure, we can't keep OBTs and stuff, but we got everything else. So it's good.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I remember, you mentioned Dark Den, his channel, Exotics Lair, those larger tarantula-based or used-to-be tarantula-based channels, they catch a lot of heat from the tarantula community because people, maybe they don't agree with the way they're keeping them or, maybe some videos are sensationalizing it. They have their haters for sure within the hobby, but I think that it's amazing how many people just by them making videos, people that had never even thought of keeping a tarantula or anything like that before, have gotten into the hobby or at least, have gotten interested in arthropods based on their channel, and their videos. And it's like maybe we don't agree with everything they do, but we can't deny the fact that channels like that are really bringing in a lot of they're raising awareness and bringing in a lot of new people into the hobby.
No, definitely. I mean, the exotics layer is fantastic. I mean, what's he got? I think 2.5 million subscribers, and yeah, he doesn't film complex or anything like that. It's I believe he just uses his phone. It's incredible. It really is, and it's just I hope it continues on this upward trend. I know certainly in SA it is. We've got quite a big reptile expo, which I will be at, and I'm going to film that and put it on my channel. But that's coming up in May. We'll be sitting, that's where reptiles go and show and tarantulas and all of that. So we've got that kind of stuff. It's nowhere near on the scale of like what's in the US. You know, you guys put on an expo and it's larger than life kind of stuff. But we've got to start somewhere. And the main thing is to educate. Specifically within other communities within SA, within the black communities, they are very wary of this kind of stuff and they don't want to deal with it and be at all associated with it. And it's about educating them as well and wanting to include them and say, hey, listen, there's so much to learn about this. Don't be scared. Just rather respect it. You know, push it out. It's not there to harm you. It's not there to hurt you. That's what we want to do. We want to educate people. We want people to say, hey, this is cool. I want to get involved in this. You know, it's not all bad. And, you know, unfortunately, I think some people just see it as something macabre and obscene. So,
yeah, I can understand that. Now, as you mentioned, like snakes and tarantulas and like their popularity in South Africa, as well as some of restrictions. Does that also apply to, like species of isopods or scorpions or other inverts? Like, is that those aspects of the exotic pet hobby growing as well? I mean, there are a lot of isopod keepers or scorpion keepers out there.
There are quite a bit of like isopod keepers, and definitely scorpions and tarantulas in SA kind of in some ways goes hand in hand. I noticed there's a lot when I go into the SA groups, there's a lot of people who keep tarantulas and scorpions at the same time. Whether or not there are specific to scorpions that aren't allowed, I'm not too sure on that. Yeah. I'm more knowledgeable on the tarantula side of things.
Yeah, I can totally see scorpions and tarantulas going hand in hand. Yeah. Like I kept tarantulas first and kind of dabbled in scorpions. And now, I mean, if you count all the babies I have over there, I mean, I've got probably 150 scorpions right now. 100 of them mainly, and probably 120 of them are just a bunch of babies. That I'm just kind of raising until I can ship them off for somebody else to sell. But, you know, it's their care is very similar. To me, they do go hand in hand, but it seems at least for a while, anytime I posted a video on YouTube about scorpions, I got a lot of negative reaction from people. They're like, we want to watch tarantula videos, not scorpion videos. Come on, man.
That's silly. I mean, come on. We're not going to start arguing as to what we should watch, like a tarantula versus scorpion. Come on. It's like, you know, that's a bit silly. I don't personally keep scorpions. I mean, my cat, for instance, brought in a scorpion the other day. Where I live, these things are sort of everywhere. And unfortunately, my cat gets very upset when she's not allowed up here when it's feeding day and stuff like that. But you know, I do have some venomous stuff, and I wouldn't want that something going wrong there. So.
Yeah, I had people laugh at me before because I've got like Arizona bark scorpions, and like right here I got Florida bark scorpions. And I mean, if you live in Florida or the Southwest, those things are like pests. You know, you gotta like call the exterminator to come out and get rid of all these bark scorpions that are on your property because you know they can be painful if they sting you, and they breed like crazy. And you know, they're like, I'm paying people to get rid of them, and you're paying to bring them into your house. It's weird how that works, but yes.
Pretty much. I mean, you know, I've gotten 5 or 6 scorpions now that have ended up in my house because of my cat, and it's just like it becomes a pain. And it's sort of on the local group of my area, people complaining, I've got a problem with scorpions, I've got a problem with this, and it's like, you know, it's goes with living in Africa, man. It's a different ball game out here. It's the Wild West.
Yeah. So how large would you say like the tarantula or just maybe like the exotic pet hobby in general? I mean, compared to other countries you've lived in, I mean, is it is it a much smaller percentage, or is it about, you know, the same kind of averages?
It's a much smaller percentage. And the reason why it is a smaller percentage is because I believe a lot, again, has to do with educating people. You'll find that the people that predominantly keep tarantulas and snakes and things like that within South Africa are the white community. I think we make up maybe, 10% of the South African population. And the black population is not something that they really want to do or be associated with. So we are trying to bring them into that hobby and give them this respect for these animals and say, hey, this is something really cool that you should, you know, get involved in. This is something that's that is not something that you should be as scared of as perhaps you might think you need to be. I know there is I can't remember his name. He's on Nat Geo, and I think he's called the Snake Keeper. He's from Durban.
Okay.
Well, he's actually from the UK, and he does a show on Nat Geo of catching snakes in Durban, South Africa. Now, Durban's infested with the green mamba. I don't know if you know the green and black mamba. Extremely venomous snakes. It's kind of like usually what he ends up catching. His show is educating the poorer communities about these creatures. And luckily, they usually call him now to come and sort the issue out. Before, it would be, you know, kind of throw gasoline on it and set it on fire, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we don't want. And that's, I think, so much of this has to do with education. That's why things like this expo that we've got coming up, it's fantastic for these people to come and say, hey, like, come check it out and, like, you know, see us handling and, you know, get involved with it. You know, the more you involve people, the more you show them, the better I think it is for the hobby and for the animals, you know? That's the way I see it. So, again, education is key to this. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, any country in the world where, you know, venomous snakes and tarantulas and stuff are native, I can understand there being fear of them. You know, like, if I was living somewhere, I mean, you hear a lot about it, especially like in Mexico and, you know, Central and South America. I mean, there's cultural superstitions and
that's what it comes down to.
Embedded fears and stuff like that. It's like, you know, you could come across a tarantula, you know, you're going to be scared of it because it looks scary. But, you know, there's also other kind of aspects that kind of, and that's usually just how, you know, you kill it, you know, like, you don't want it on your property, but
you've basically hit the nail on the head there. It comes out as well to cultural superstitions as well, where, you know, snakes, in a lot of their cultures are predicted as bringers of evil and, you know, sort of these evil spirits and things like that. That's the difficult part, is trying to show people, you know, that, you know, when you are thinking something from a cultural perspective, it's very hard to change your mind and say, that's not the way it is. It's this animal isn't like that. It's not what you've been brought up to believe it is. Yeah. And the same goes with tarantulas and things like that. And, you know, it's trying to show people, like, you know, this animal deserves respect. It's difficult, but I think all of us in the hobby at the moment in SA, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, we have similar things here in West Virginia, like not just West Virginia, but like there's a lot of Appalachian kind of, you know, cultural, I don't want to say prejudices, but, you know, it's probably not the right word for an animal, but you have fears of different insects or snakes or, you know, even like bears and mountain lions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That goes, you know, way back to people settling in this area. And they were, you know, bad omens, or, you know, especially up with a lot of, I don't want to say gypsy either. I don't even know if that's politically correct to say, but yeah, there was a lot of like kind of folk magic and stuff like that, you know, way back when, you know, West Virginia was, I don't even know if it was a state yet. People were just starting to live out here. And, you know, so there are some, snakes in this area that just are almost extinct, you know, like they're very, very hard to find. Because they were just killed on site, you know, and some of them weren't even venomous. Like it was just, you know, they were considered bad luck, or, you know, people didn't want them. They were scared of them and they killed them off. And you see that happening all around the world when it comes to a lot of exotics, you know, a lot of, especially snakes, scorpions and tarantulas or spiders in general.
It's an unfortunate way it is. And just, you know, that's, I'm so, I keep going back to the point, like, you know, your channel, my channel, you know, anybody doing this, it helps the hobby. It's, you know, and I just honestly hope it continues. I really just hope it continues.
But I think it's almost like a genetic memory in a way, you know. It's like, it's just part of the survival instinct of humans to be afraid of snakes and spiders, because it's like, they can be dangerous. You know, you get a tarantula in your sleeping bag, you know, it could cause you some pain.
You kind of freak out.
Yeah.
I think I was 10 years old. I got into bed. I pulled my sort of blanket up and I could feel something on my chest, like almost compressing. And I was like, what's going on here?
Oh, wow.
And I pulled this thing down and I had this, I'm not joking, the size of my hand on here on my chest. And I freaked out, man. I just wanted to, like, I ran off this thing and all I wanted to do was kill it, but it got out and it was gone. And that was like a big scarring for me. Like, that's why I just couldn't stand any tarantulas in my house. And we also get things called rain spiders, which they're not tarantulas, but they are as big as a tarantula. They get very, very big, long legs.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stand these things. And we used to get them in our house. Anytime it used to approach, like, raining outside, they would end up inside their house. They're arboreal, so they go sort of into the corners of your roof and things like that. And I just wanted to kill these things as quickly as possible. I didn't want to know about it. And I was petrified, like, honestly petrified of it. And then it was, I don't know what it, as I say, it was just watching Dark Den and seeing this, and I was just completely blown over. It's like, I can handle snakes and lizards and all of that, and I love it. It's like, why not give a tarantula a try? Why not open my mind a little bit to it?
Yeah.
That was the changing point. And now, I mean, I'm looking next to me, as I say, I've got tons of slings, juvies, mature females, and stuff. And yeah. I love it. It's awesome.
I mean, if we're going to be diving into scarring childhood memories, like, I think
where
my fear of inverts came from was, I was born here in West Virginia, and shortly after that, my family moved out to Oklahoma. They were living in Oklahoma City, and I was there for first few years of my life. I think it was about, by the time I started kindergarten, we had moved back to West Virginia, like right before we started. So, I mean, like, my mom's parents lived out there, and I remember, like, my first, you know, I don't remember a whole lot going that far back, but one of the first memories I have is moving from Oklahoma City back to West Virginia. Like, I mean, that was a pretty big event, packing up your entire life. And I have a few scattered memories in Oklahoma, but the sharpest, most, you know, the furthest back I can really get. And it was, we stopped at somewhere in between, I don't know where. But we had stopped at a rest stop, you know, kind of like stretch the legs, use the bathroom, stuff like that. And I saw this huge stag beetle, in the rest stop. You know, it kind of looks like a big cockroach, but with, like, huge pinchers on it, you know, like just this, like, big, huge, nasty pinchers, almost like a Hercules beetle or something like that, but not that big. But I remember seeing it and being like, oh, that's really scary looking. I'm going to stay away from that thing. I don't know what the heck it is. And I remember telling my parents about it while we're getting in the car. And then we got a few miles down the road, and then something pinched me really hard on my chest, and I start screaming. And my dad, like, pulls over, like, what the heck is wrong with you? I'm flipping out, rips my shirt off, and one of those beetles had somehow gotten into my shirt,
man.
And just, like, it pinched the crap out of me. And it wasn't so much that it hurt. It just was terrifying that I saw something, was like, I'm going to stay away from that. And then I don't even know if it was the same one. It could have been many of them in that area. I don't know a lot about stag beetles, but I know that one had somehow gotten into my shirt and pinched me as a kid, you know, probably 4 or 5, something like that. And, like, from that point on, it was like, anything that looks like an invert, I'm scared of, because if I see it, then inevitably it's going to end up inside my clothes and hurting me. Kind of similar, like, with poison ivy. Like, I'm very allergic to poison ivy. So it's to the point, like, if I see poison ivy, then I know I've probably already gotten it. Like, well, I see it. So that means I've touched it, or just maybe being in the proximity of it. I know that's not how poison ivy works, but it just always seems to be the case.
What was sort of the point for you where you sort of got over this? Like, for me, it was, as I say, watching Dark Den. That was, like, what spurred the interest to say, hey, I want to do this for yourself. What was it? What was it that was, got you to sort of look at these things differently, if you will?
Well, back then, I think YouTube was mainly just, cat videos and skateboarding videos. Like, it wasn't, I don't think there was any tarantula videos back then. But it was, I was in college. It was a freshman in college, taking a philosophy class, sociology. I was, like, really big into philosophy and sociology. And I don't remember if it was my philosophy or sociology professor. I think it was the philosophy professor. We were talking about fear. and just kind of, you know, just the psychological aspects and, you know, essentially like one of the things I had mentioned that I was the most scared of were spiders, you know, and it was like, this just kind of like, it was a liberal arts school, like a private liberal arts school, very Lutheran. So it was just a lot of like very rich Lutheran Catholic kids. And then there was like, I was like the token, it wasn't like, I would always joke and say I was like the international student or something like that. But
right, okay.
They're all from the Midwest, you know, like Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota. You know, it's like that kind of like very Lutheran kind of like the 98% of the school was from that area. So I was kind of like the foreign kid from West Virginia. Like they gave me a full ride when I applied because they were like, hey, you got good grades. You play the French horn. He'll give you a full ride if you want to come because we need some diversity.
Okay.
I'm like, I'm a redheaded white guy. How in the world am I like a diversity in this school?
Coming over.
So, yeah. Awesome. So I was already, even though, you know, I already was kind of like the oddball because I was from so far away and from West Virginia and was not Lutheran or Catholic and was very punk rock and not rich, you know? So it was like, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that part of it, but I was like this like rock and roll kid in a bunch of preppy kids, and everybody was kind of scared of me. Like they thought I was like the tough, you know, scary guy. There was a couple of us that kind of hung out, and you know, I worked at Hot Topic, which was like the demonic, like it was the demonic store at the mall. but I was scared of spiders and really wanted to kind of get over that. And my professor had suggested facing your fears, like your fears based on the unknown. Like if you learn about them and kind of expose yourself to them a lot, like that exposure therapy and education will get you over that fear. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to try this. And I'm allowed technically to have a tarantula in the dorm. Like you could, there were very few pets you could keep in a dorm room, but it was like betta fish, as long as you didn't have like a filter or a heater in it, which is a horrible way to apparently to keep betta fish. But a lot of the girls in the dorms, like they all had betta fish in little tiny fish bowls. And I was like, well, I'm not going to get betta fish because that's what the girls are doing. But I went to the local pet store. They had like a rosehair tarantula, maybe like 10 bucks, something like that. And got an aquarium and a lid and, you know, set it up. And I would like, I mean, by the end of this, my freshman year, I was like pulling it, like handling it, like taking it out of its enclosure and letting it just crawl around on me while I'm like sitting there studying and just pretty much to freak out my roommate. Like I was working at Hot Topic. He was working at Abercrombie and Fitch. So you can imagine we didn't get along very well.
Very, very different.
Yeah. And he was scared of spiders. So if I wanted the room to myself, I would just have my tarantula hanging out on my chest or, you know, like as I'm laying on the couch, letting it crawl around on me. He'd open the door, see the spider, not say a word, and just turn around and leave. Like, nope, not dealing with that.
Oh, Jesus.
So yeah, that's how I got into it.
It's really, really crazy, but that's awesome. So the university professor that got you to sort of change around. Oh, awesome, man.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it's from that point on, it just kind of became, I don't want to say part of my personality, but it was like, I always had a tarantula, you know? So like, no matter where I moved, you know, I'm like I said, I would travel all over the country. And I would just take the enclosure and stick in the passenger seat. And like have all my CDs in the floor and seatbelt them in and take off driving. And that also helped a lot with hitchhikers, like especially going back and forth from like South, because you know, it was like a 24-hour drive from Sioux Falls back here to West Virginia. And I would inevitably always find some weird, you know, hippie chicks or something like that, that wanted to ride and be like, well, I got a tarantula on the front seat. And they'd be like, yeah, you know what? We'll wait on the next one.
We're good. Maybe next time. Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
This one girl got me real good. It was somewhere. I don't even know where it was. Not too far. Like kind of in between West Virginia and Sioux Falls. And stopped at a truck stop. And she was wearing like Carhartt overalls. Are you familiar with like, you know, like, and no like shirt or anything, no shoes, just Carhartt overalls, big, huge dreads. And part of it was like, she had a serious tan line, you know, cause she'd apparently been out in the sun for weeks in the summer with wearing just those Carhartts, but there was also a lot of dirt. So you could see like this like white band of skin underneath the strap of the Carhartts.
Oh man.
And, And she was, and I was heading from Sioux Falls, from South Dakota to West Virginia. So I'm heading east, and, she comes, you know, approaches me. I think my friend was in there with me, and she was like, "Hey, where are you guys headed?" What'd she say? I'm heading east. Which way are you guys going? And I was like, "Oh man, I don't want this girl, in the car. I mean, she's cute, but she also looks a little crazy and probably smells really bad." I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry. We're heading west." And she was like, "Oh, that's cool. I'm actually heading west too. I'm heading to Sturgis." And I was like, "Oh, she tricked me." Now I got to be like, "Okay, I was lying. I'm actually heading east." So I was like, "Well, crap." So I was like, "Well, we're heading east. I'm sorry. I lied to you." And she was "Well, I'll go east too. I just got to get out of this truck stop." And then I was like, she comes up to the car. I'm like trying to figure out how am I going to ditch this poor lady. And then she sees the tarantula. She's like, "Is that a spider?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's my pet tarantula." She's like, "You know what? No, I'm not going to do this." And I was like, "Yeah, Rosehair, save the day." Yeah, it was pretty funny.
So in the States, are you allowed to sort of, this is from just my own curiosity. Can you move whatever tarantulas to each state, or are there states with rules that say, "Hey, you're not allowed to do that. You have to either get by here within state or maybe not even allowed."
Yeah. Well, up until recently, the past few years, to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't really any restrictions. At least no restrictions that I was aware of and followed. You know, it's like if I would move, I would just take, but I mean, when I was doing that, I only had maybe one tarantula at a time.
Yeah, of course.
It didn't have a huge collection. Pretty much my whole lifestyle was I only own what will fit in my car. You know, Ford Escort, you know, so it wasn't, I didn't have a whole lot of stuff and, a couple of guitars, a bunch of tapestries, some clothes, CDs, and a tarantula. Like that was pretty much it.
I love the way that goes. Yeah. A couple of clothes, CDs, and a tarantula.
The important things in life.
Yeah. The important things. Nice.
Go to Goodwill, wherever you end up, buy some furniture, some secondhand furniture, and you always got tapestries to hang up on the wall so it doesn't, you know, look like a trap house. And I guess then it just kind of looks like an opium den, but it's still, I think it looks a little more settled in. I would do that. But recently, as in like the past few years, there's been some, you know, some species that, especially with CITES protection or Endangered Species Act and stuff like that. Like there's 6 or 7 Postalotheria species that legally, like technically you can't ship them across state lines. I think like the T. celadonia is also in that same kind of situation where it's like, if you have it like within your own state, you know, with the Postalotheria, some of those species, you can breed them and sell them within state lines, but you can't ship them across state lines I think it's the way it's worded. It even says like, if you move, you can't take them with you. Like they got to stay with them.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Jeez. And it was like, you know, they were being bred and sold all across the country for years, but then they changed, you know, they became threatened, I guess, in the wild, which put them under a different classification under CITES or whatever Endangered Species Act that is involved with that. And it made selling them and technically transporting them across state lines illegal. It's one of those things that, like, I don't encourage anybody ever do anything illegal, especially with the exotic pet hobby, because we want to be as responsible as possible. But it's also, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not giving any legal advice, but I have a feeling that, you know, if people had these Postalotherias in their species and they moved, more than likely they would just bring them with them. It's really, I think they really enforce it on, you know, selling them, you know, and importing and stuff like that.
No, of course. I mean, one thing I also noticed about the States is when I wanted to buy there, you guys have so much variety. I mean, you can choose from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shops. Something you may want to know about SA, we don't have that variety. So you'll find prices maybe vary by $5 to $10 a pop. That's it. You know, if I wanted to, I could sometimes save $100 on a species, but let's say buying it from Texas, or instead of buying it from California, let's say. That to me was just, I think about it when I'm here and I'm like, I miss that variety, man, especially like choice in price.
Yeah.
Man, I really, really miss that. You guys have definitely got, your options, let's put it that way.
Yeah, there's no shortage of dealers, but the trick, the issue is finding a dealer that sticks around, you know, like there's maybe a handful of tarantula dealers that have been around for more than 5 years and are doing well. Like there's an endless list of businesses that start, like somebody started breeding tarantulas. They, you know, they had five or six different species, some egg sacs, and they start trading them around, getting other spiderlings. And like, I'm going to open up a business, sell these direct, because you make a lot more money if you're breeding, selling direct to customers as instead of selling them wholesale to dealers. So they do that. But then I think just the weight, like, especially if you start becoming successful and you're getting a lot of orders and just the stress of that and keeping all these different species and maintaining the website, and especially with all the Facebook regulations that are out now restricting live animal sales on their platform, you really need to have a website, and just the cost and time, you know, just kind of goes hand in hand with running an online business, becomes overwhelming, and they start screwing up orders, you know, like, big one you see a lot, especially in the past few years, is they're breeding, they start a business, they're doing well, they're successful, and they're like, you know, I'm going to get an import from another, like from Europe. And it's kind of, you know, because a lot of times you're spending like $5,000-$10,000 or $20,000 on an import of getting, you know, hundreds or thousands of spiderlings, a whole bunch of different species. And to offset that cost, they'll do a pre-import special. So they'll give you like 25% off the retail price if you pay up front for the import to kind of help them get all that money together. But then something terrible happens, like it gets confiscated, or, you know, like the import gets confiscated by customs, or like a large majority of them die, or some of the species they ordered didn't actually get shipped for one reason or another. So then you got a lot of customers that are upset because, you know, this what they were expecting to get in like 4 weeks is now delayed 10, 12, 15 weeks. And then they end up not getting the species they want, or they don't get any at all because a whole shipment gets confiscated. And then you get a lot of really upset people. And now you've got, you know, you, as the businessman, you know, you're going to intentionally, you're like scam people, but you took their money and you spent it and lost that. So now you're on the hook to refund them all this money, and you end up going broke as far as like a business, and then they just disappear. So you see that happen a lot. And there's a lot of controversy in the tarantula hobby, I think, here in the States about the prices, because it's having a free market with supply and demand, the market kind of determines what the price will be for a specific species, you know, like how many people are wanting to buy it versus how many are available to be bought. And it's one of those things that, like, if it's too high, the price is too high for the species, then don't buy it. And eventually they'll have to start lowering the price incrementally until it gets to a point that people will start buying it again. And that's kind of how the price is determined. So you'll have like a standard price for a species, maybe we'll say $100, but then somebody that's not a tarantula dealer, that just like breeds tarantulas or whatever, they'll breed that species. And that'll be like the only tarantula that they have available for sale, but they want to move it. And they know that, like, if I sell it to a dealer for wholesale, they're only going to give me $10 a piece. But if I sell it retail, I can get $80 a piece or $100 a piece. So they'll just sell that. They'll just, you know, put that on the market, and like the only species they have, a limited amount, but they'll sell it for a whole lot cheaper than, you know, your tarantula dealers will, because they want to move it, get rid of them. So, you know, then that creates controversy, because people will see some guy on Arachnoboards selling this species for $50 a piece. Then you go to like your major breeders websites or dealer websites, and they're selling for $100. So they're like, oh, they're way overcharging. And it's like, it's not really price gouging. It's just, you know, it's just how the market works. Like, you know, they have thousands of tarantulas that they're keeping, and they're not, you know, it's just, so it can be frustrating, you know, but it really comes down to if you got to pay shipping no matter what. You know, if you're buying one tarantula, you're buying 20 tarantulas, you're getting overnight shipping, you're paying $35 to $50. So, you know, you could go to a dealer that has 20 tarantulas that you want of different species and get them all shipped in one box, or you can go to 10 different people and buy one or two tarantulas each and pay shipping, you know, 10 times, which, you know, can get really expensive really fast. So it really just depends.
It's just surprising to hear that, you know, there is sort of like that people in the States do get, you know, that sort of happens where if somebody undercuts, you know, let's say what a retail store's selling it for, that people actually get upset about that, because you think with the population that you guys have, that wouldn't be an issue. It's sort of like, you know, it's kind of expected with, you know, the amount of people that live in the US. I know we have the same thing here where people get very, very iffy and bridges are burnt very quickly if you start undercutting, you know, the big guys and whatever. You know, it causes bad blood, let's put it that way. So it's you've got to be careful on the way how you sell. If you, like, let's say my Indian Violet, let's say now I get her paired up, she has a sack, and I start selling that off, and I undercut it by, you know, let's say $20-$30. There's going to be some big guys in the industry saying, what are you doing? You know, that's kind of, people are coming back to us, and that's causing problems for us, you know. And fortunately, it's like my name sort of, I'll chat in SA because I'm now on YouTube and people see it in SA, and it's like, I'm a very easy target to go for if I had to do something like that, you know. And sure, I sort of, that's why it's kind of interesting to hear that seems to almost happen as well in the States, because I was always under the belief, you know, States is sort of, you know, the way it's, as you put it earlier, it's a free market, you know. States is, it's capitalism and really at its best. It's, you know, I want to undercut you, I'm going to undercut you. There's nothing wrong with that. I can do what I want. You know, it's interesting.
Capitalism at its best and worst, I would say.
Yes. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. No, I'm probably talking a little out of school here, because I'm not really, I don't like breed and deal tarantulas really. So this is all like secondhand information and observation, but I don't think any of the large dealers really pay much mind to the smaller guys. You know what I mean? Like they're not offended or going after them. Okay. But it's more that from the customers, like that's where the controversy comes from. Cause maybe some people don't quite understand, you know, I think capitalism is what, you know, our country essentially is based on in a lot of ways, but they don't really teach it in school, I think, in a way that a lot of people maybe understand it. So, you know, they think that they don't see it from a capitalistic point of view. They just, all they see is this person's charging $50 and that person's charging $100, or the person charging $100 is a scammer. And it's like, no, that's not it. You know, but so they get upset. They're like, well, I feel like I should have to pay the cheapest price available for this tarantula, no matter where I'm ordering it from. And it's like, well,
you live in a free country, dude. Go and buy from the guy who sells it at $50. You know, it's like, and that's kind of what I want to happen here. And I think there's a lot of people that, you know, a lot of dealers here now that are going to hear that and be like, that he shouldn't have said that. But it's true. I believe in this sort of capitalism in some ways. I believe in people trying to better you on price, whatever, because it keeps the market exciting. It keeps, you know, things alive, if you want. When things become stagnant, it's always at the same price and it's always going to stay there. That becomes boring in a way. And it's like, you know, there should be competition. People should be out to outbid each other. And dropping prices allows those who maybe couldn't afford, you know, something a bit rarer, that allows them the opportunity to now get their hands in something like that. And that's exciting. Look, I understand people also want to make money. You want to have something rare. You want to breed something rare and you want to make cash in it. I do understand that. But there's, you know, it's. I don't believe you should be ostracized. And I think South Africa is a bit guilty that way. If you start undercutting majorly, some guys are going to get very upset with you because we don't have the market. Yeah. So let's, as I said, between 2,000 and 5,000 people, and 5,000 is like being very generous. Let's call it 2,000 to 3,000, if you will. You know, 2,000 to 3,000 people, you have an egg sack from, you know, let's say a salmon pink, which is what, about 2,000 eggs. You drop the price of that majorly, all of a sudden you've flooded the market and you've basically sold it off, all of it, to 2,000 people. They're going to be upset.
Yeah. You know? So you kind of got like a tarantula mafia out there.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. You know, so that you've got to play a very, there's a fine line and how you go about doing it. And it's just, I've, you know, there's a couple of the major guys here that I've spoken to and I've said to them, you know, I believe there should be more competition. There needs to be more competition. Prices are too, you know, here we use the South African rand, and that varies between 50 and 100 rand on some species, nothing ever more than that. And if you to put it into context, 50 rand is maybe $3 or $4. That's 50 rand. You know, the price difference of $3, that's nothing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's, it does lead to some interesting situations. Like, for example, the Postlotheria metallica, the Goody sapphire ornamental tarantula, very popular blue Asian arboreal. I remember years ago when it first came in the hobby, it was, I mean, a spiderling was like $200 or $300, maybe more.
Oh, wow.
Like, I know people that, you know, bought adult male or adult females that paid $500, $600, maybe $800 for it.
Wow.
You know, it was very expensive, but I mean, even just as like maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, you know, the spiderlings, like I said, there could be anywhere between $100 to $200, but then there was like this like 3 or 4 month period where they had like, and you can almost track it. It was like they first came into the country on a large scale. A lot of people were buying them. And whether they bought spiderlings or juvies and they reached adult age, or they just bought adult like pairing, like adult male and female, kind of like a couple just for just to breed and pair. And they got the spiderlings, you know, they had a successful pairing. They got a sac. So it was like all of a sudden there was multiple people that had P. Metallica spiderlings for sale. A lot of businesses just like people are like, they started a business just to sell, you know, their tarantulas, and the price of those slings went down, I think, to about as low as $25 a piece, you know? Oh, so wow, it was like, okay. A lot of people got really upset because they're like, I paid $200 and here a couple of years later, you can get them for 25. Like I got five P Metallicas for free. Man. I bought like a raffle ticket or something like that in some Facebook group years ago. And won, and like, I mean, I paid $5 or something like that for the raffle ticket.
Yeah.
And won five P Metallicas. And at the time they were selling them for $25 a piece. So it was like $125 value, but crazy, a year or two later, now the price of those slings are back up to like $100, $150 in some cases.
Okay. So that's quite pricey. I mean, you know, to put in perspective, I got a P Metallica, she's a juvie now, and she was just approaching juvie when I got her, and I would say she probably cost me $40 was what I spent on her. And it's a wonderful species, but I mean that puts it into perspective, I guess, price wise the differences between SA and the US. But I mean, this I can't remember what it was. I think it was a Mexican red rump, I'm sure it was. And I saw some, I mean, how much did those go for in the States? Let's say a mature female.
Oh man, I don't really know. I would say not much. The red rumps are pretty common over here. I think that the slings are usually like $20. Mature female though, probably a couple hundred.
You see, a couple of hundred for it. And I think we sold them here, I'm not joking, $20, $30. $20, $30 on a mature female.
Oh, wow.
Is what you pick one up. You know, that's how it's so interesting for me to go back to the US and sort of see what you guys are charging for certain things and what we charge. Yeah. You know, obviously again, it's different countries, different prices. It can drive you crazy.
But I mean, don't quote me on that price. I just pulled right out of my butt. I don't know where it came from. Just an assumption.
I think I just saw it and I was like, I just got a big shock from it. I was like, man, that's expensive. I'm like, we don't play anywhere close to that.
I mean, when you're talking about like full grown, like a mature female tarantula, it doesn't even really matter what species. I mean, you go to the Petco or PetSmart or like whatever the big box chain pet store is, and they'll have, you won't even know if it's female or male. It'll just be like a subadult or adult tarantula, and they're charging over $100 for it. I think I was just at the pet store a few days ago. It was a Petco, and it just said assorted fancy tarantula, $199.99. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, that looks like a Vaughan's. Like, that looks like a Mexican red rump tarantula. Why would somebody, like, that's not a fancy tarantula. You know, they just see it's a large tarantula, so we're going to charge a couple hundred bucks for it. And I looked it up real quick. I'll check like 3 or 4 different places. Like right now, P. Metallica spiderlings are right around $100 from, you know, that's kind of the average. So, I mean, that's 4 times what the price was, you know, like my time frame is like 3 or 4 years ago, maybe. They were a lot cheaper. And
I mean,
I would say probably in a year or two, there'll be now that their price is up, a lot of people are going to start breeding them again. And then the market's going to get flooded with spiderlings, and people are going to be fighting each other on, you know, trying to have the lowest price so they can sell theirs as quickly as possible. And the price will go back down to $30 a piece. And that happens with a lot of different species, you know, and there's so much competition out there. I mean, back when I first started buying tarantulas, I don't even know if there was, you know, there was like message boards that people would like make a post and they'll have like a list of what it is they're selling. But you know, it was years before there was like websites, businesses devoted just to that. You know, maybe your reptile dealers would sell some tarantulas or something like that. But now there's hundreds, I would say, maybe not hundreds, but there's over 100 different businesses, at least in the US, that are selling predominantly or exclusively tarantulas, and maybe like 5 or 10 that are like large, you know, if that makes sense. Like,
right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, see, I mean, here we've got, I would say online sort of to purchase 5 or 10 websites. That's it. And then you have, I don't know if you guys experience the same problem, but you know, here you'll have a problem where there will be one guy who has something fairly rarish and he's the only one who's gotten them to breed.
Yeah.
And he has complete control over what that's going to be sold for. You know, we don't have enough people keeping and breeding to say, well, if there's a bit of competition, now we can start competing on price. You know, obviously the more casual stuff, most people have got those. But once you start getting rarer, that becomes the problem. That's where people can sort of say, the price is going to be this. Either you can afford it or you can't. Tough, you know. I don't know if the States, if you guys have much of a problem like that. I mean, you know, but that's definitely a bit of a problem.
Oh, yeah. That is a constant source of controversy as well. Like somebody will get a species in, especially, you know, they'll have it imported in from Europe or something. They'll be the first one to have it available for sale, or maybe they'll breed it. It'll be the first U.S. sac. And not many other people have it. And I mean, it really doesn't even matter what species it is, it seems. Like there's usually one business will get it first, or maybe a couple of them will. Like they'll go in on an import or something. And, you know, they'll charge anywhere from $250 to $600 for a sling of this species. And you'll have some people that, you know, it just kind of like buying a Tesla or something like that. You got your early adopters are going to pay a whole lot more, you know, to be the first to have, you know, new technology or new tarantula species in your country, you're going to be paying top dollar. And then like, you know, as those sell out, people start importing them in, or they're getting bred and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden the price on them is dropping. Like right now, T. Celadonia, initially when I think when they first, and the legality of selling them is also just a controversial topic in and of itself, but
oh, really? Okay.
Initially they were being sold. I think, they were listed between like $600 to $800 a piece. And recently, I think the last time I saw them, they were probably like $250 a piece, but now there's been so much attention brought to that particular species from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that it's, since they technically weren't supposed to even been imported into the country. And now pretty much there's a lot of people that are breeding them and then have them, but they're not really selling them. If that makes sense. You know,
right. Okay.
They don't want to.
It's just, again, interesting hearing your prices. I mean, $600, $800 for something like that. I mean, I think the most I've seen is the Brazilian jewel. I've seen slings of that go for about 5,000 to 6,000 Rand, which is about $400. Yeah. I'd say at the high end mark. That's what you're going to get. That's what you're going to pay.
I believe that is the T. Celadonia, the Brazilian.
Is it? Okay.
That's all the same.
Okay. So we're talking about the same thing. Sorry. Yeah. As I say, my common name, Latin name, I'm still trying to learn it all. So,
but I mean, when they were being sold here openly, it was, you know, people were charging $500-$600 we'll say for a T. Celadonia, but over in Europe, they were maybe like $100 or $200. I think somebody even said they got some T. Celadonia slings for less than $100 a piece in Europe not too long ago. So they're breeding a lot more over there. They have them available. They don't have the laws and restrictions that we do here in the States when it comes to some species. So yeah, that's kind of interesting, but when you're talking about other species, like a Faunapelma morae, which is like, it kind of looks like a green bottle blue, but it's an Faunapelma species. And there was like none in the hobby at all, at least here in the US. And then, one or two businesses imported them in. They had, you know, from Mexico, and they had to go through all of the, Mexico has a lot of restrictions right now about, exporting tarantulas, and they got to be certified and all this other kind of stuff. They had them imported in and they were selling them for like $300 a sling, I believe. And a lot of people were buying them. I think now the price of them is down to like 250, 235, maybe 200 bucks, something like that. It's still an expensive spiderling. I've got a few of them and I've had them for a few years now. I got them like as soon as they came in. But they're still small spiderlings because they're a Faunapelma. It's going to take them years and years to even be able to show that color. Like right now they're just gray and black. You know, it's like they haven't even got the blue and orange kind of coloration and green coloration yet. So I'm really excited for those to be full grown. Cause I mean, they'll be a beautiful tarantula, it's just, it takes so long. So some, it's really hard for some people to justify spending $250, $300 on a spiderling that they're even, no matter how gorgeous it is, even though they're not really going to see any of that coloration for 5 years or so, maybe longer.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a bit of keeping teas is a bit like, in a way, almost sometimes like gambling. That's the way it is. It's, you know, because you'll spend $300, $350 in a sling. That's if it survives, you know, then you'll see it. You know, you still got to look after it from this tiny little thing, you know, and sometimes you run the risk of it dying. And that's, I guess that's where people see it, you know, $300, $350 down the toilet, basically. It's a crazy industry. That's the best way to put it.
That's very true. Yeah. And now in South Africa, are there, what are the most popular species, in the hobby?
I would say your popular stuff is like the salmon pink bird eaters, curly hair tarantulas, Vicularia. Trying to think of the other ones that sort of stand out. But I'd say those three immediately come to mind. That's kind of what people go for. It's relatively cheap. It's not that expensive. I mean, a curly hair these days you can pick up for, I'm not joking, $2 or $3. So yeah, it's very easy for people to get into the industry and pick one of those up. Again, salmon pink bird eaters, not much difference there. The Avix are about $20, $25. That's when they want to get a bit more, you know, higher up into something.
Yeah.
You know, Brazilian blues is also another one that stands out. People enjoy keeping those. And then when we've got them, people enjoy the Brazilian blacks. People really do enjoy those. But again, there's a problem of supply with those at the moment. I think there's two guys that I know of who might be breeding later this year, who might have XX later this year. So what those prices are going to be this time around, I dread to think. That's the way that goes.
So essentially it's like the same species for the most part that are popular in the US or the UK. I mean, those are pretty standard species. One question I do have, is something, again, it's another thing that I never really thought about, until recently doing this podcast and YouTube videos kind of getting popular and just giving me the ability to talk to people around the world. Like here in the US, we've got like all kinds of different suppliers of enclosures, you know, like, I mean, we've got like Tarantula Cribs that sponsors this podcast.
Yes.
They make enclosures just, you know, for tarantulas and inverts, but you know, also got like glass enclosures from Exoterra and Zilla and Zoomed, mainly for reptiles and stuff. But there's no shortage of acrylic glass, enclosures around. Plus we've got all kinds of just do it yourself, kind of like buy a plastic bin and drill some holes in it, make an enclosure.
Yes.
But like talking to people in other countries, especially like, like the Philippines or, you know, some Central and South American countries, they can't go to a pet shop and buy an Exoterra enclosure. You know, there's the cost of shipping the glass, internationally, those glass enclosures is very prohibitive. So there's just not a whole lot available. So I'm wondering, like in South Africa, what do you guys use for enclosures most commonly?
So first of all, for those interested, we do get Zilla, we do get Exoterra, we do get all of that range. It is just, I'd say, near double the price of what you would pay in the States, because you've got to bring it in and then there's taxes imposed onto it. And it's just the price skyrockets on it. So what a lot of guys do is they do use glass enclosures. I was using Perspex, which was actually, these Perspex enclosures are made by a local guy. And he supplies directly to the pet shop that I buy from. I did market his stuff for a bit on my YouTube channel, and you know, it was sort of it's been doing very well. It's been going very nicely. The problem is that Perspex has to be imported from Germany into South Africa, so the price of that becomes very pricey if you start keeping a lot of tarantulas. So I've recently had to move to glass. Glass is cheap. Glass is not going to, you're not going to pay a lot of money for that. There are two people that I know offhand that make custom glass enclosures. And I'm talking for a beautiful glass enclosure for a mature specimen. You're looking about 450 Rand, which is just shy of $30, say about $25, $28 for a beautiful glass enclosure with vents and sliding this and that and, you know, perfectly done. So I think guys that keep a lot will keep in glass. Guys that keep not that much, yeah, just they're trying to move into perspex because it's a lot nicer to deal with. But I'm, as I say, even myself, I've sort of moved now to glass just because the amount that I'm buying and the amount that I've got, it's just financially makes no sense to spend, you know, 5-6 times more on just having perspex when I can have glass.
I gotcha. Yeah, it's so. Yeah. Would you say that? I mean, moving beyond just tarantulas, like when we're talking about right, other exotic pets and stuff like that, especially like okay, snakes, you had mentioned racks, like rack systems, yes, and things, yes, like that. I mean, do most people that are keeping snakes keep them in racks, or do they use glass enclosures?
So again, it comes down to how many they have. If you have a lot of something, generally they're going to try and go for a rack system. You know, for instance, the guy that I've bought my stuff from, he's doing fantastic at the moment, selling rack systems to specifically the ball python breeders. So that's what they want to keep. If you are keeping one or two, three snakes, there are custom made enclosures. Usually it's like wood enclosure with glass in the front. So it's good at keeping the heat in and stuff like that.
Yeah.
People are obviously, you know, quite, I like to say that most people I've dealt with are rather educated and, you know, tell people, hey, don't go for an all glass enclosure. It's going to let the heat escape. Doesn't keep it in. It's terrible for that kind of stuff. So yeah, you know, it's kind of created a bit of a business there for people to make local goods for this market.
Yeah. I've actually been considering that myself because right now my snakes and geckos and stuff are all in glass enclosures because that's available. But I've been watching a lot of and talking to a lot of guys in that aspect of the hobby, and they've really been pushing like the PVC enclosures, you know, because right, okay, you know, they hold the heat in well. You can have like,
yes,
lighting and heating, everything kind of integrated into them, and going to some reptile expos and seeing some of those available for sale, it's very tempting. And, you know, I've really been wanting to do that, invest in getting kind of like I did a collab with Adam from Wiccan's Wicked Reptiles, and he has all his, okay, snakes in those kind of like PVC enclosures, and they look really sharp. It's I definitely want to do. It's just cost prohibitive right now. Like switching over right, to doing content creation full time has really,
of course,
drastically cut my budget that I could spend on that kind of stuff. So it, like the money I make off like YouTube revenue went from being like you know, just like spending money that I could reinvest, yeah, on like camera equipment and, you know, enclosures and stuff like that. And like, now I got to use that to pay the power bill and water and mortgage and stuff. So
it's funny you mentioned that, because I remember when I was trying to sort of do film properly and sort of you were a big inspiration to me wanting to do the YouTube thing. And then I was like, well, how does he film that? Okay, so I need to try and see what he's using for these shots and whatever. And I went to my local camera store, and man, is it expensive. Like, you guys are lucky because you can sort of go to Amazon and that gives you a ton of options to choose from.
Yeah.
Again, this is where SA, we don't have those options sometimes. It's like, you've got to buy the expensive stuff, the stuff that is like, you know, perhaps not a knockoff. It's got to be top of the range. It's come in with import duties. It's got added VAT and tax and all of that. And it's just like,
yeah,
it's crazy. So then I'm like, I'm back to my two phones. I mean, I literally film with one phone here and one phone on the side. That's how I do it. You know, so
yeah,
it's like, I say to myself, when I start, you know, putting ads on, I start making a bit of money that way, then I'll invest in that stuff, you know. So,
yeah. I mean, the way the cameras are on phones these days, it's, I mean, they're, I think the new Samsung Galaxy S21 or whatever, I just saw an ad on TV and it was, I think it shoots in like 6K or 8K, something like that. I was like, geez, that is amazing.
My main camera at the moment is the Galaxy Note 20 Ultra, nice, and that can film 8K, you know, wow. So.
Yeah. I've got the Note 9, I think. Really? I can do like 4K, but yeah, I got the Note 9 when I've had it for a few years now,
right,
maybe like almost 3 years at this point. I got it when it first came out, because I was using the Galaxy S7 to make my YouTube videos with, and I don't even think it could shoot in 4K. It may have been able to shoot in 4K like on the rear camera at like 30 frames per second or something. And that's what I was using to make the first YouTube videos. And I started having problems with that camera. It just wasn't looking right. So I was like, well, right. I need to upgrade my phone anyways. So I got the Note 9 and was making YouTube videos with that. And mainly I got that one because it had the 4K capability and like 60 frames per second. Gotcha. And I did that for a while. But the guy I was working for Christmas a few years ago, because he was noticing that I was really getting into making YouTube videos and was like, well, let's step it up and get you an actual camera. So for Christmas, he got me a Lumix G7, which doesn't have image stabilization or anything like that. Yeah. It doesn't have slow motion, but it's like, you know, it was a mirrorless camera, a mirrorless DSLR. And that, and I think it was like, he got it off eBay used. So it was like maybe $300-$400 or something like that. It wasn't that expensive. Gotcha. It was kind of like my Christmas bonus. He gave me that camera.
Last Christmas bonus. I mean,
yeah, it became an investment, but I mean, that was the first camera I ever owned, you know, like actual DSLR type of camera. So I had to learn a lot about just, you know, focusing and ISO settings and aperture and just the frame rates and just things I never, like with the camera on your phone, you just kind of hit record and it's intelligent enough to figure out all those settings for you. Yeah. But really kind of digging into that, on that Lumix G7 really taught me a whole lot and kind of like got me into photography and videography. And because I had bought lenses for that camera, I've just stayed with that body. Like I've upgraded to the G9 and the GH5S, kind of like their flagship photo camera and their flagship video camera. And they're pretty identical, but it's like all those lenses are interchangeable, right? So, I mean, I can't really go with a Canon because then I have to sell all my lenses and buy Canon lenses. And that's where all the money is in the lenses. Like that stuff gets, camera's expensive. Sure. Wait till you see the lenses.
It's like, as I say, I mean, when I was watching your videos, I was like, because I never saw, I would always go to your description. I'd see like, does he have a list here of what he's using? And I'd have to try and like kind of figure out like, what is this guy using? Like, because his quality is so good. And then it's like, as I say, I went into my camera shop and I showed them one of your videos. I was like, you know, just help me out here. Like, what can you see? That is anything you can tell that this guy's using? It's like, I think it might be this. I'm like, cool. Let me see the prices of those. I was like, okay, I'm just going to stick with the Note 20 Ultra for now. It's doing me just good. in regards to my lighting, I'm just going to use a desk lamp and another desk lamp. And that's going to focus the light in one central point. Yeah. That's how I'm going to do it for now, you know.
So, I mean, I am a cheapskate when it comes to this kind of stuff. So I always wait for like Black Friday sales or some kind of discount they have on like lighting or, you know, tripods and stuff like that. But I also I get a lot of stuff, like you said, Amazon or eBay, like, I mean, especially with lenses and stuff, like you can get a used lens for a third of the price of getting it new, you know, cause somebody they upgraded their camera and they can't use the lens anymore. They're just trying to get rid of it. So I've gotten some real good deals there, but I mean, there are some lenses that the only way to buy it was like the Laowa probe lens, like this macro probe lens. I don't know if you've seen it. It's long. It's amazing lens, but brand new, it's like $1,600. You get it used, it maybe $1,500, you know, like the resale on it is insane. So yeah, it's kind of like, well, if I'm going to buy it, I might as well spend the extra $100 and get a brand new one. Yeah, I know it's going to be scratched or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, things like that, those are the more expensive things that I've bought, but I have all of the camera equipment that I use on my Amazon storefront, you know, so you can click a link and it has like all the lights and cameras and pretty much anything I buy off Amazon, I try to remember to link it to there.
I'm definitely going to check that out because it's just, I mean, you know, for an aspiring YouTuber of like myself, it's good to see what guys like yourself are basically using. It gives us the sort of something to work towards and sort of try and understand how you get the shots that you do, you know, because there is only so much a phone can do. I mean, I believe sometimes, you know, my phone captures great quality and great content, but there's only so much it can do before it becomes, you know, it's nowhere near as good as, you know, using something like you yourself are using. So,
yeah. I mean, for what it does it really well, but you're very limited in the range, you know, like you can only get so close to something, you know, then you have to you have to just start zooming in and then the picture starts getting pixelated and shaky.
I mean, it's like, you know, and I've got this, I was trying to do that the other day with my mature female Indian ornamental. I don't want to get too close to her with my hands and like, you know, sort of dragging my phone up to her. It's the last thing I want to be doing. So, you know, I need something that can, you know, sort of grab the quality from a distance is the way to put it.
Yeah. And those macro lenses, I mean, cause especially with like things like aperture, like being able to control that depth of field is something that can be very difficult or almost impossible on some cell phones. There is an app I've suggested to some other YouTubers called Filmic Pro. I think there's like a free version, or maybe it's like 10 or 20 bucks to get it. But essentially what it does is it opens up all of the settings, makes everything in your camera customizable.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So you can even like, you know, give it like a cinema kind of color grade, high dynamic resolution, really control.
Check that out. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It really kind of turns your cell phone into a DSLR, but it's still limited in focal length, you know, like you can only get so close to something and it focus, you know, which is just, I mean, that's just, that all has to do with just the lens on the camera on your phone, you know, like it's limited, because it's so small and stuff. But with those, I'm actually been considering, or not even considering now, I've decided I'm going to do it. I just am working on like putting it together, but making a video that's just about, the camera equipment that I use. Cause so many people like yourself have asked me questions and it's like,
definitely,
I think there's enough interest out there. I haven't done it because I feel like the majority of people that watch my videos, they're just interested in tarantulas, you know, and it's if I make a video about camera equipment, they're going to be like, what the heck is this? I don't want to watch it. But
no, I think it's an awesome idea. I think that, you know, even as I say, for people like myself to see what you've got, and maybe even just a bit of just chatting about how you use what each thing is used for would be amazing. That would be amazing to do. Definitely.
I'll definitely have to do that. Definitely. But it's, you know, it's also the fact that like, I am not a professional, you know, like I literally started learning this stuff 2 years ago, I guess this past Christmas would have been 2 years. So it's like, you know, everything that I've learned from watching YouTube videos on how to make YouTube videos or how to use cameras and a lot of trial and error. Like every video I put out, I try to like learn something new for that video, you know, like, I'll be working on color grading or, alternating frame rates or, you know, messing with the settings in the export, like, export it at 24 frames per second instead of 60 frames per second or 30 frames per second, and seeing how that works and experimenting with lighting and music and mixing. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm going to learn this skill and I'm going to work on that in these videos until I really got it perfected to where I like it. And then we'll move on to the next skill, you know? So if you start watching my videos, the very first one, and kind of go in chronological order, you can almost see the development. Like, okay, now I got this camera, I'm going to work on focusing and smooth transitions. And for a few videos, and people are complaining like too many transitions. And I'm like, well, yeah, but that's what I was trying to learn how to do. So like every time I changed scenes, there was a transition. Like now I've learned how to do it, and that you can totally overdo it. So I try to, you know, limit it and, less is more when it comes to that kind of stuff, or working on different apertures and lighting. And like the biggest one was audio, you know, for a long time I was filming, but I was just using the mic on the camera or like this cheap mic that I had on the other side of the room pretty much. And then I started learning about audio engineering and getting that mic as close to you as possible. So now it's like the mic is always like maybe a foot away from me, but it's just out of frame, so you can't even see it. But it's changed the audio quality drastically. And I get asked that like from other YouTubers, like Adam from Wiccan's Wicked Reptiles. When we did our collab together, he was like, what kind of mic are you using? Like your audio sounds so much better than mine. And I'm like, it turns out we're pretty much using almost very similar mics. I think his was a little bit different, but it was like the same manufacturer. And it's like the biggest difference is I don't have it on my camera like a vlogger would. I put it on a stand and moved it a whole lot closer to me. And then I used these settings in the editing software to kind of, you know, just make it sound better. So it was like, you know, it's little things like that. You gotta just kind of learn about it and practice it. You know, it's just like anything else. You practice and practice and practice until you kind of hone it. But
look, I mean, I'm making mistakes. I find probably maybe too often in my videos, I apologize and I say, hey guys, you know, I'm trying this new technique. Let me know in the comments below how you find it and all of that. And, you know, it's because like you said, it's a constant learning process. So especially for myself starting off now, again, it's like with this crossover from one scene to the next and cutouts and fades, and is this too long? And audio is a big one. I mean, the other day I was using the mic I'm actually speaking through now to sort of do a voice cover over. And I was just, the mic from the camera was way better. This one was sort of, you know, sort of recording something and then speaking as you're doing it. So, well, recording as you're editing the video, I just felt it didn't work for me at all. So that video I wasn't very impressed with. It's finding your groove and what is the best way to do it. And it's a learning process. Some videos are going to be a fail, and I've learned to accept that. Some are going to be great. It's the way it goes.
So how long ago did you start your channel?
I started my channel, I believe, about 2 months ago, but I've had this specific account for, I would say, 4 or 5 years that it's actually been active. Okay. When I say active, I'm talking like 2 or 3 videos a year. And it was predominantly, I had, there is stuff on my channel from when I was living in the US. And I think it even has my old name, which was Diablo 363. It was a very edgy sort of, you know, name that I had going on. There I had stuff with my snakes and some unboxing stuff from Jamie's Tarantulas. And then I did a lot of unboxings of tech stuff. Well, not a lot, but a couple, but I've since deleted a lot of that stuff. And then, yeah, about 2 months ago, this is when I changed this whole thing. I thought, right, let's do it properly. Let's do a nice banner. Let's get an Instagram account going. Let's get this focused nice, and let's have a cool name. Let's get rid of that edgy, you know, sort of name that was created when I was 12 years old kind of thing.
Yeah.
Fix it up. it's good, and I'm enjoying it. I'm definitely enjoying it. I think the biggest problem as somebody who's new is you're trying not to have a lot of repetitive stuff. You know, and a lot of my stuff is rehousing. So it's as I get something in, I rehouse it, and I, you know, show what I'm putting into the soil and stuff like that. So it's trying to find that happy balance is the difficult part as a new YouTuber. But, we use you guys as inspiration as to what to do.
It seems like there's really two avenues you can go when you start making videos about tarantulas and exotic pets. You can either do like the vlog style type. I don't know if that's a right word, but kind of like you're just documenting your experience and lifestyle as an exotic pet keeper, you know, so you're doing a lot of rehousings and unboxings and feedings and, you know, just kind of making almost like a diary or a journal of like what's going on day to day kind of stuff. Or there's the other avenue where it's more like educational, I guess, you know, not so much a vlog.
Yeah, I definitely get what you're saying. You know, it's look, I try and throw in a bit of education into my video. So if I'm talking about, let's say I go back to my most recent one, which was my Indian violet, I throw in, you know, a little map of where they occur from, a little bit of the stats of what temperatures they should be kept at, what the substrate should be. Are they fossorial? Are they arboreal? You know, I put in a little bit of that. And then I always explain, I guess, it becomes repetitive what I'm explaining and why I'm putting in isopods, why I'm putting in springtails. Because at the end of the day, somebody could come across the video who's never seen my channel at all. It's the first video they're finding of it. And that's why that information's in there. I can't put it in one video and expect everybody to know that it's going to be carried on over to the rest of it. So
that's very smart. Cause I mean, I look at the stats of my videos, like more than 50%. I mean, it's usually like somewhere between 55% to 60% of people that watch any particular video are not a subscriber, you know, like they're not someone that follows the channel regularly. Of those people, a lot of them, I would say, I got 1,000 views on a video, probably 30 to 40 of those, 300 of those 1,000 people are unique viewers that have never seen any of my videos ever before.
Exactly. You
know? So it's a good chunk of people that they don't know. So I get some flack from people that watch every week or twice a week or however many times I'm uploading at that moment. And they're like, you know, all of your care videos are the same. Like, I'm like, especially like with Brocky Pelmer or Fauna Pelma, they're like, it's the same exact information. I'm like, mostly. Yeah. Like, I mean, as far as like what enclosures I'm using, how I'm caring for them, how I set it up, like all of that is essentially the same. You know, the only difference is when I'm talking about the locality, like where they're native from, or, you know, they're like how they look. And it's like, you know, there's small differences, but I go cover all of it in each video because there's a lot of people that's the only species of tarantula they have, and they are researching that one species. So I need to get all that information out in that one video, even if that's, you know, a good chunk of that is in every other video that I do that's species specific. Like they're probably not going to watch any of those videos because they don't have that species of tarantula. So they're not going to get that information. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of got to include that.
But what's nice is that I see that you do on yours is you sort of timestamp it very well so that, hey, listen, if I don't need this information, I can just go to jump to and say, I just want to find out where it's from or, you know, a specific piece of information. And you know, that's something that I've definitely picked up from your videos that I'm going to start doing on mine, you know, is putting timestamps in. I think that's a very good one so that people can skip the information they don't want. It makes them carry on watching and they can just watch the stuff that they want to focus on.
Yeah. I mean, and that's like multiple reasons for that. I mean, one, because like, I mean, we're in this like TikTok culture now. So like if a video is more than a couple minutes long, so people just don't have the attention span for it. So that helps get them to the information that they need immediately. But it's also the way that YouTube and Google search has kind of merged recently. They've got like, if you do those chapters in your videos, if someone searches like how to feed a Brachypelma homori or something like that, we'll just use that.
Okay.
How to feed your Mexican red knee tarantula. You know, I made a care video about that, but I don't actually say feed in the title probably. So it's not going to come up in the search results very high. But if I use the chapter feature and have a section that's just feeding your Mexican red knee tarantula, then that's going to appear really high in search results. And it'll have the video queued up to that exact moment. So like search that. And then like the first thing that pops up is, you know, that 2 minute clip, and they can click on it. It'll start right at the feeding section of that video, but then it'll keep playing. You know what I mean? So like they could watch that. And if that hooks them in, then they'll continue watching through the other chapters of the video. So it really helps with search results.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. I'm definitely going to remember that. Yeah. That's something I'm going to start throwing to mind. I mean, I think I've got a rehousing now of, there's going to be a lot of people jealous in SA over this one because I've got, four, Jeep Ultras. Nice. And those at the moment are pretty rare in SA. They're not everywhere. They're not abundant.
Yeah.
I've got four of them at the moment and I've got to do rehousing. I want to do like a rehousing all four of them in one video. And I think that's something I'm definitely going to throw into my next video.
Yeah. And figure it out before you start recording. You know, that's something I've learned is, you know, if I know what people are going to be searching for, when I do a species specific video, I'll do like an overview kind of section and then like a locality and then like a temperament or venom and then feeding and then like husbandry or enclosures. Yeah. Like I just kind of figure like try to, you know, using like Google Analytics or search engine optimization or, you know, there's all kinds of tools out there that you can like type in the name of the tarantula. And it will give you a list of results of what people are searching based on that, you know? So majority of people are looking for care or they're looking for feeding or they're, you know, so I can figure out what it is they're searching for and then kind of build the video based on the information people are wanting and have it broken up in chapters before I even start recording. It's like, okay, I know I'm going to go from this section to this section to this section to this section and then can break it up in chapters and that optimizes it for search results and evidence, which leads to more people finding your content and watching it.
Of course.
Yeah. Which is pretty interesting.
Awesome. Thanks, man. That's definitely like valuable information for somebody like me who's trying to make this work. You know.
We've gone from a podcast to YouTube counseling.
yeah, YouTube counseling. That's what it is. And then there was something I did want to bring up as well.
Sure.
So if you want to get a bit of grip and see where we are at the moment with keeping teas in SA, there's also book, I believe it was called Tarantula Gallery. And it's by a guy called Danny DeBrain. It's actually on Amazon or whatever. And that's, you know, he's did a whole book, I think it's of 50 species with gorgeous pictures that he had taken and how to look after them and all of that. You know, the fact that guys from SA are releasing books like this is fantastic. You know, it shows you we're definitely getting up there. We definitely, it's on the increase.
So it's a book about tarantulas. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's a book about, I'd say at the moment, like the common tarantulas that we have in SA that we're keeping. And then it's just lists as well, the sort of temperatures that they should be kept at, a little bit about where they're from, a bit about the venom. And then it's got about a page worth of just husbandry notes and explaining, as I say, things like temp and things like that. And yeah, I think that's actually on even Amazon.
What was the title again?
It was Tarantula Gallery.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people will be interested.
Volume one's out, and I spoke to him the other day, and he's working on volume two. And that's a guy from South Africa who released that book. So
awesome. Yeah. We'll definitely have to check that out. People ask all the time for good, like recommendations for good books on keeping tarantulas. And it's like, there's not a whole lot out there, and a lot of the books that are out there are pretty outdated at this point. So it's always cool to hear about new stuff that's coming out.
Yeah, I mean, this one was released, I think, last year. So I use it now as a quick reference guide to learn about something, or even sometimes just to go through a bit of nighttime bed reading, and I see something and I'm like, ooh, that looks cool. I definitely need to get one of those, and I sort of write it on my list, and I'm like, I need that.
Yeah. So, a few years ago, I went through this phase. I say a few years ago, it's probably like 5 years ago at this point. But I just was searching on Amazon like once a week for used books on spiders and tarantulas. Yeah. So I was like buying all these biology books on like tarantula, spider biology. And I mean, I've got like a bookshelf over here that's like, it's full of books, but they're all books on either like mindfulness, Buddhism, meditation, or spiders and arachnids. It's like a mixture of my two hobbies. And I haven't read all of them. And some of them are just like, are horror. It's almost like I bought it as a collector's item. It's like some book from the mid 90s that was like a scholastic book club. You know what I mean? It's like a book for kids, like for a elementary school library or something. It's got some cool pictures, but some terrible information. But it's still, it's like, it's a book on tarantulas. So I'm going to buy it. It was like a dollar.
That's a win. That's a win. That's
awesome. It was like, I ran out of money and room to collect tarantulas. So I started collecting tarantula books, I guess is what happened there.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Good stuff.
So, as you had mentioned, I mean, we're starting to run low on time, but when we were talking about having you come on the podcast and stuff like that, you had mentioned that you asked if it was cool for you to like tell people in your tarantula groups there in South Africa about what were you talking about? What kind of groups do you have?
I don't know if you know, it's called WhatsApp, and it's used predominantly all over the world. I just found in the Midwest and South, nobody really uses it. New York, well, East and West Coast, they know of it. But it's like we have tarantula groups specifically focused on that. And it's like you kind of use your phone and you go in there and you there's 300 people in the group. And, people post all their tarantula-related content. And then, I just wanted to tell them, like, hey, guys, I'll be on, Tarantula Collective. This is what's happening. I'm waiting to confirm a date time because, we were back and forth trying to confirm when we would do the show.
Yeah.
And it's, I just wanted to basically let them know. Then I had, I told them, I was like, it's probably happening Thursday. And then I never updated anybody. Then today, actually, I got people messaging me. He's like, hey, did you do the show yet with Tarantula Collective? Is it up? We want to watch it. And I was like, it's not done yet. It will be done this evening, though. So just sit tight. It's going to be up. But we've got a lot of Facebook groups and, let's say, WhatsApp groups. And unfortunately, at times, those groups can be a bit toxic. But I guess it goes with anything like this, it's just the way it's going to be.
I think it's anytime you get more than 10 people together, like 10 humans in a group, and it's going to start getting toxic.
I think especially online. The other day I posted some meme or something like that in the one, cause WhatsApp sort of displays it displays all your most recent conversations. And I posted a meme in it by accident without even thinking up. Was supposed to post it and send the meme to a friend. Somebody's like, this isn't tarantula related. Remove this junk off here right immediately. Think before you post. And I'm like, do I post the by accident? Don't be rude. Like, calm down. I know it's tarantula focused. Like, chill. Just,
I've never used WhatsApp, but I mean, like you said, it seems like every other country in the world, like one of the most popular apps that's ever downloaded. Yeah. But for whatever reason, in the US, it's not.
It's just not. I mean, I know Europe and obviously Africa and sort of Asia and whatever, they use it predominantly. And then when I was in the Midwest, I was like saying to my buddies, like, hey, do you use WhatsApp? And I'm like, what's WhatsApp? It's like, don't worry about it. I'm not even bothered. It's fine.
Strange how things like that happen.
Yeah, cheapest. Yeah. But to be fair, America is like its own sort of sectioned off place. It's sort of, I always say it's like there's the world and then there's America. And whatever happens in America is its own thing. It's like, it's got its own thing going on.
It is.
Which is good. It makes you, it's like, it's special. It's nice. You know, I enjoyed it as a foreign, you know, non-American. I freaking loved it.
So. Yeah. But it also, I mean, it's one of those double-edged swords. Like, there's some benefits to that, but there's also, you know, we're just oblivious to some things, you know, like embarrassingly enough.
Yeah, that is for sure. I mean, as I say, some of the questions I was asked when I told people I was from South Africa, they're like, how did you get over here? Did you use a boat to get over to America?
Well, that's why I'm like really glad that you were willing to come on the podcast and that I could talk to you, because, you know, I've never really talked to anyone from South Africa in depth.
That's
and it's really cool to be illuminated about, you know, how the exotic pet hobby, you know, it kind of goes on over there and some of the differences and stuff.
That's sort of why I wanted to, you know, kind of do it, because I think some people have a sort of a warped perception that, you know, oh, it's South Africa. It's like, all you can do is go there and grab the animal and take it out. Like nothing happens there. It's like, no, stuff does happen here. It's like, you know, we do have these things. It's just not highly publicized and nobody's doing it, you know? And that's when I got decided to do this channel. I was like, somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to get out there and expose it and show everybody else what's going on.
So, yeah. And when you had talked about like local groups, in my mind, I was envisioning, kind of like what they got going on over in the Philippines. It seems like, and I haven't taught like really had anybody from the Philippines on the podcast yet, but I'm hoping to do that in the near future. But it seems like they have, and I may be way off base because I'm just things I've seen and heard people talk about, and maybe I warp them in my own mind, but it seems like they have like tarantula clubs, kind of like groups like that meet in person. You know what I mean? Like there are a bunch of people that keep tarantulas get together and talk and hang out. And I always was kind of jealous of that. I wish there was something. I mean, we kind of do that like at expos, but it's more like you just run into people. You know, you're not like.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing here. These days, I would say it mainly happens at expos. There is an expo coming up, I believe, this weekend. It's kind of a smallish one. I unfortunately won't be attending, but again, that's where the guys will meet up and, you know, people will trade and, you know, purchases will be made. But it doesn't, it used to happen many years ago in herpetology, but nowadays I don't even think that happens anymore. It used to, but
yeah,
I mean, these days people go on a Facebook page.
You know? Yeah. The need of meeting in person is kind of been eliminated.
Which is a pity. I would prefer meeting in person, but
yeah. It's the way it is. Well, I'm going to be in Chicago in October of this year. My wife's cousin is getting married. So we're going to be there for the wedding, but it just so happens they're getting married the same weekend as the North American Reptile Breeders Convention, which is like the largest, you know, reptile breeders convention in North America. And a lot of arachnid dealers there.
Wow.
I've gone a few times in the past and I've always been, there's a lot of different tarantulas for sale. There's a lot of booths that only sell tarantulas, but I've also been able to meet a lot of people that, you know, subscribe to my YouTube channel, watch videos. The first time I went, maybe like 5 people recognized me. The second time I went, a couple hundred people did. And at that point, awesome, I was only like at like 10,000 subscribers. So now it's like over 65,000. So I'm a little nervous about going, but I'm thinking about doing like a meet and greet kind of thing. That's not the right word. Meetup. That's it. Meetup.
Like a meetup. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody like will find a restaurant or a bar or something like that. And
that's the way to be. I mean, you know,
so you don't even have to go to the expo. We can all just meet up and hang out and talk and, you know,
look, I mean,
buy and sell tarantulas, like, trade them.
I obviously at the moment don't have anywhere near the amount of subscribers that you do, but I mean, even at my little place where I buy my teas from, I've got people that come there and say, hey, you're Mike's Exotics. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. And it's like, dude, it's like awesome. I found out about this place from your video. And like, it's nice. It's nice. Like, I guess giving back in a way to this community and making it grow and like showing people like, you know, there's a lot to this, like come and join it. Like, it's fun. It's kind of like this cool elite club. Like, you know, it's not just these sort of, you know, some people view it as like weird kids, like goth emo type kids like this. No, it's everybody. Right. Everybody can be in this club. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. Like the only place I've ever really been recognized though was at that at NARBC, you know, and
right, okay.
I went to a local reptile expo and like in Pittsburgh, and the only people that recognized me or at least said anything to me were like the people I was meeting there. You know, like it was a couple of tarantula dealers that was like, hey, you're going to be at that show. That's like an hour from me. So I'll go and say, hey, and do a little bit of recording. Right, okay. And went up there and saw them. But when I go to like the pet shops around here, nobody knows who I am. It was with one exception. There's one young lady. I went to buy crickets at a pet shop, and she was like, was looking at me really weird. And then kind of like got excited. It was like, you're the guy from the Tarantula Collective. It's like, yeah,
awesome, man.
Yeah, I am. You're the one person in our area that has any idea. But recently I went to, a couple of dealers sent me some free isopods and tarantulas and stuff recently. So I had to go to FedEx Hub to pick it up. And my old job, I was there like once or twice a week, dropping off stuff that we were mailing overnight. And was like, you know, of course, also buying and selling, mainly buying tarantulas. Yeah. So anytime I got a live package, I would go there and pick it up. So kind of got on a first name basis with the little lady that works behind the counter there.
Yeah.
And she was just always really curious why I kept coming in and getting these packages that said like live inverts or live animals on them. So I was telling her about it. And, you know, that's been going on for like 3 or 4 years. And just this last time I went, somebody had sent me some rubber ducky isopods and I picked them up, and she was like, I finally watched your channel. And I got to say, I'm very impressed. That's really awesome. Interesting, really cool. And I'm like, thank you. I told you about it 4 years or like 3 years ago. You're just now getting around to it, but that's awesome. Like, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And then like, I guess that was the time before she said that. And then when I went back this time, she was like, a couple of people that have come in that have that pick up animals that are live. I ask them what they have, and if they're snakes or spiders, I tell them they should go check out your channel. I was like, well, thank
That's
you.
Awesome.
I got a little, she's promoting my channel at FedEx.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's how I'm going to sort of go about promoting my channels at our main expo, which happens in May. It's actually at like a casino that sort of has, you know, grounds that you can hire out into the expo. So that's where I'll be. But out of curiosity, I mean, how many people attend the expo in Chicago?
Oh man, thousands. That's
really, really?
Yeah. Wow. I have a video on my channel. It's called Road to 10,000 Subscribers or something like that. Okay. It's about the last time I was at NARBC. And you know, there's a line. I mean, it's a huge expo. Like it's just a huge, I don't even know what you got, like convention center.
Right.
And so like the line starts, you know, at the door and goes all the way down this really, really long hallway to the other side of the building and then loops it around and comes all the way back. So like I got there, I was like, cause you know, I went with Fear Not Tarantulas and she paid to get me like the VIP pass or whatever to get you in early. So like I had that, but I got there and just saw the line of people like hours before the doors even opened. Just standing there. Wait, I was like, this is insane. So I like recorded it, got my camera. Was like, kind of walked down the line. Like you guys will not believe how many, I mean, hundreds of people there hours before it opens just so they could get in there right away. And then it's just shoulder to shoulder packed the entire time. And I was actually the last one I was supposed to go to had, you know, got the VIP pass and all that kind of stuff, was really excited, had all my camera, everything packed, my clothes, everything. We were going, it was the one in March. And it was like right when COVID restrictions were starting to come out. Like it had just really been announced. It was like New York and Seattle and LA. Those larger cities were starting to see an increase. I was like, well, this is not in Chicago. It's outside Chicago. And like I said, my wife has some family out there. So I was like messaging them every day. Like, what are the numbers looking like? What is the local news reporting? Are you guys shutting down businesses yet? And they kept saying no, no, no. And the people that were putting on the NARBC were saying, you know, we're going to, no matter what, it's going to be open. Like people are already here. You know, dealers are already here ready to set their tables with all of their animals. I had hotel reservations and my wife kept saying, we should just cancel. We shouldn't go. I'm like, oh, this is all a bunch of hype. It's not a big deal. Like we'll be fine. They're not going to shut it down. And it was literally like the day before, like I said, everything I had was packed and ready to go. And we got in this huge argument with my wife about whether I was like, if you don't want to go, you can stay home. I'm still going. Yeah, I made a commitment.
I'm going because it's going to happen. It's
yeah.
Yeah. I get
like, I already have, like I have dealers that I'm supposed to be meeting up with to get enclosures. Ooh. And you know, we've got a lot of stuff that we got. I can't do it. I got to go. I'm committed.
I get you.
And then it was like the night before, the governor came out and said, no gatherings with like more than 10 people or something. So it was like, yep, there's no way.
That's not my man. I mean, look, I would love to attend something like that. I think it would be something special. I mean, cheap as that amount of people. It's like, yeah, it would be nice. I just got to get the channel sort of going a bit and then go there and hopefully a couple of people know, hey, you're that South African guy. Yeah. So please, like, no questions. How did I get you? Through a plane, just like everybody else.
Yeah. It was kind of funny because that was like the first time when I was filming that last video when I was there, that was the first time I would like go up to vendors and kind of be like, start asking them questions, and they already knew who I was. And we're like, oh man, I'm a fan of your channel. And I'm like, you know, my channel, this is weird. My wife got a kick out of that. Cause I'm a pretty socially awkward guy. Like I could do like the customer service face and have small talk for a couple of minutes. But like once that's run out, like, okay, I got nothing else to say to you. Like, I don't know what to do now. I'm awkward.
We've been good for like 2 hours, 10 minutes. So you've done pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, hopefully some people recognize me from the, from my YouTube at this expo that we've got coming up. And as I say, I'm going to be printing a couple of t-shirts and things like that. Just nice stuff to give away and just, hopefully interview some of the vendors and let's see what happens. It'll be, as I say, it's nice for, again, I think like, people from overseas and specifically the States, like for them, it might be something interesting to see like, whoa, that happens in Africa. Like they've actually got these expos and stuff that occurs, like, you know?
Yeah. I would be interested in seeing that for sure.
Oh, awesome. Man. Awesome.
And, you know, I've got your, if anybody's watching the video version of this on YouTube channel, I have Mike's Instagram and YouTube channel scrolling across the bottom there. If you want to go check it out and subscribe it, I also have all that information linked below in the description of the video. But if you're just listening to the podcast, just search Mike's Exotics on YouTube and you'll find his channel. Check him out, give him a like, watch some videos, subscribe, all that fun stuff. And when we started this, the podcast, I was looking up your Instagram and realized that I was not following you on Instagram. So I went ahead and did that as well.
Thanks very much, man.
I'm really bad about that, following people on Instagram. So yeah, definitely check out his Instagram as well. So how often do you upload? Like, if somebody's wanted to check out your content, when can they?
So I try and upload at least twice a week. This week's been a little bit chaotic. I've had like all sorts going on with my house and renovations and everything like that. So the next video should be up tomorrow, which would be the 13th of March. The next video will be up, and that's going to be a rehousing on 4 poultries. So
nice.
Should be a nice one.
Cool to see. I appreciate you being willing to come on the podcast. We're a little over 2 hours now, so we're going to have to wrap it up. But I think it's interesting. At the beginning, you were like, I don't know if we're going to have enough to talk about.
I was just going to say that. Like, I was like, dude, I mean, you know, are we even going to make it to an hour? And now I'm checking it. I'm like, it's been 2 hours, 12 minutes. This week, man, it's been quickly.
Yeah. Well, once you get talking, time starts flying by.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, seriously, it was so awesome to chat to you and just like, spread the word a bit. So thank you. I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing with us what it's like keeping exotic pets in South Africa. It's been a very interesting perspective, and hopefully in the future, you'll be willing to come back on again and talk about other topics, maybe more.
As soon as COVID restrictions have lifted, I want to go back to the States just to visit a couple of times. So, be great to meet up, maybe do a joint show, something like that.
Possibly. Awesome. Yeah. People ask that a lot. I get a lot of messages and emails and stuff from people that want to come by and check out the collection. And it's like, if my setup was like the Dark Den and I had a space that was just the tarantulas and stuff, that would be one thing, but I'm in the basement of my house and I'm pretty picky about who I let know where I live.
maybe we'll meet up at a convention or something. We'll do it that way. That's the easiest way of doing it.
Yeah, possibly that would be very cool. I would enjoy doing that.
Cool, man.
But yeah, well, I'm going to have to wrap this up, but thank you so much for coming on. Everybody, make sure you go check out Mike's Exotics. He is on YouTube. He's on Instagram. You'll really enjoy his content. And, if you enjoy these podcasts, make sure that you subscribe. If you're watching this on YouTube, You could just hit that subscribe button, the Exotic Pet Collective on YouTube. Or if you want to go, if you're listening, because this is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can find the Exotic Pet Collective. So make sure you're following it. And if you have a moment, leave a review, because I just learned recently, if you leave a review of the podcast, it really helps the algorithm, kind of feed that algorithm, get that information out there so more people can find it. So I really appreciate it if you can do that. And I just want to also say thanks to Tarantula Cribs for being such a huge supporter of the Exotic Pet Collective podcast, as well as my YouTube channel. Great people. Check them out. The Exotic Pet Collective, or that's not their website. Their website's tarantulacribs.com. So before we go, Mike, I just want to say one last time, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure everybody listening did as well.
Thanks for having me, man. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All righty. Well, thank you everybody for listening. And I guess we will just, we'll see you all next Thursday. All right. Have a good night. Bye. All right. And we are wrapped.
Cool, man. That was awesome. Thanks again.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was nice getting to know you and talking a little bit. So thank you. I appreciate you doing that.